people never even thought about going.
Well, good morning and welcome, everyone. Today is Thursday, September 28th, 2017. It is 9 a.m. This is the Josephine County Board of Commissioners, at least two of us, here for the weekly workshop that we have. We're going to change the agenda up just a little bit. We're going to move forward with item number two, the Treasurer, Order Number 2017-045, in the matter of uncollectible personal property taxes pursuant to ORS 311.370. We have Ms. Eve Arce here today to talk about this, something we do on a regular basis.
Annually, what we do is we go through and look at the personal properties that we cannot collect. We work these collections until assessment has deleted the account. We go after these pretty aggressively. The only thing that we really don't do is go out physically and see them. And by the time we're getting to cancellation, they're long gone.
There's not a lot of value associated with some of these.
Correct. We do have two that are large this year, and one is the Dutch Mining LLC. That was a really odd thing that we did. It was a mining company that was up in Reuben Mountain, up in Wolf Creek, almost Glendale. And so it had mining equipment, then all of a sudden it just disappeared. Because I think that this is only, it's a total of $80,000 that we'll be writing off and 70 cents. But it's like a four years taxes that we couldn't get them. So I actually transferred all of this to the real property that was owned by them also. And unfortunately, after transfer, since my liens take, or at a certain date, the lien holder of the property foreclosed me out. So I lost my liens.
You lost it all?
Yes. Even if I hadn't transferred it, it was still gone. But that was a last-ditch effort to try and collect these taxes, put it against the land, get them to pay it so they didn't lose the land.
Right,
unfortunately,
right.
The lien holder came in and
his first
wiped
right.
It out.
And yeah.
Yes, because their lien was older than mine.
Just went on to
so I lost that one. And the other one that's quite large this year
now, the lien holder, are they responsible for it now? They're not responsible for taxes.
Not these personal property taxes.
Not the personal property tax, but the property taxes.
Property taxes, yes. They have to keep those up. And unfortunately, those are like a couple hundred bucks a year.
Can't transfer that back out? Not now.
No, not now, because that's actually what I did, is I transferred it to the land and I had to remove it. Because they did, it was through the courts and everything that... Because I held on to it as long as I could until I was forced to remove them.
Is the personal property tax still due to us?
Yes, it's due to all of them, yeah, to all of the districts, yes.
To the districts, yeah.
Yeah, and we do have the liens out there that says they have to pay them, but it's to the point where I have no leverage. Yeah. The equipment is long gone. There's nothing there to seize. There's no people that, it's called Dutch Mining LLC. And if you trace that back, I can get to Atlanta, Georgia, and three or four other entities that I don't know who they are. And my liens mean nothing to them. I'm just going to ignore it. So, and then the other large one is Road Group LLC, and that was written off through a bankruptcy. So I cannot enforce that anymore. They wrote that off.
How much discretion do you have with personal property taxes? Somebody asked me that the other day. They, I think they own a restaurant in town. I can't remember exactly who it was, but it was their restaurant equipment was being taxed as well.
Right. And that's that with restaurants and stuff. It is the equipment that they use for business. It's not their inventory. It's not their food. It's not anything like that. And what the value is what they put on their return. Each year the assessment office sends out a return and says, list what you have. List your depreciation, and they value it on that. If they depreciate it out, it goes down. And, of course, the threshold for personal property, I think, is at about $16,000 now. So if your value is less than $16,000, there is no tax. You're exempt. So it's... Personally, I think
I was always told that it was like serial numbered items on personal property.
I can't answer that one because I'm not. That is an assessment thing, and it is also a confidential thing. But I do know that in restaurants, your spoons and your forks and stuff, that those, I think, would have to be listed as part of your equipment, as part of your business. But I don't know.
Personal property.
Hmm?
Just a theoretical question. Why do we tax personal property, not just property taxes?
We used to tax chickens and cows.
Right?
Yeah. Actually, quite a few years ago, Carl Wilson, when he was in the legislature the first time, is actually the one that got the threshold in. And it started at $12,000, and it incrementally increases each year, mm-hmm. just for appreciation. So it's just part of the taxing system. It's always been there.
Interesting.
Personal, and there's actually just a few mobile homes that are personal property, so they have quite a few years that assessments finally deleted. They can't find it. The one with the most years there, the Woods Mobile, we've been trying to chase that down. We haven't known where it was since 2002, and the commissioners finally said, or not the commissioner, sorry, assessor finally said, oh, okay, we'll delete it.
Good. Yeah, that's it. Clean up the books.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I'm in favor of moving this forward to the administrative calendar, if you're okay with that, and speaking to it, because it does affect the other districts,
mm-hmm.
and if there is any kind of consideration, I think that's appropriate that it be on the admin calendar. But maybe one of the only things we have on that. But if you don't mind, or your liaison, I'm not your liaison.
Yes, you are.
Well,
yes.
I don't mind speaking to it either.
Thank you, because I have a very important thing to do Wednesday morning.
I can speak to it.
Thank you.
Not my first time.
Perfect.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Eve.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Legal's not here, so we're going to go on to department business, community development. We have Ms. Schmelzer here for item number one. It's 2017-2018. It's already membership dues. And then item number two is economic development requests for RCC, Small Business Development Center, SBDC, in the amount of $45,000.
Right, so this was actually in our budget, and when the bills started coming in, I brought them forward to the board to see if we could just process all, instead of having them come individually before the board, have them all just approved, kind of like we do other normal dues throughout, like the planning budget or building safety budget. And it was at that time the board wanted the request to come in individually, like we're looking at today. So that's why I have them before you. The first one is pretty straightforward. It's the SREDI dues. It's $25,000. They are looking at a different matrix and due system, but that would not be effective until the next budget cycle. So the $25,000 is for this year's dues. And then,
don't we also pay $10,000 or $5,000 for the EDGE program to highlight 5, 10
right.
businesses in Josephine County? So
yeah.
We're going to continue doing that, right?
Right. They come in periodically and want either money for EDGE or for the FAM tour.
Yeah.
So those I'll continue to bring forward like
okay.
we have in the past.
That
but
sounds good.
It's not uncommon to see those come.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I'm thinking we're going to see a FAM one coming pretty soon here. And then with the...
What were you using?
FAM, it's a familiarization tour.
Okay.
We just had one. We just got, in fact, I went to lunch with the group that was here. How often do they do those, I think?
Well, twice a year.
Twice a year?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the second one is the the Small Business Development Center. And they actually filled out the complete form like they've done in the past. What happened with this one was the request was for $45,000. But when we were working on the budget, we actually cut that down to $35,000 is what we budgeted instead of $45,000. At that time, you know, I had asked them, what do you need the money for? And they basically said that it was $25,000 is the cost of basically a staff person and then $10,000 for RLF administration. And so that's what I had presented in the budget was the $35,000, and that's what the board had approved.
RLF is revolving loan fund. The previous board had made kind of an agreement of $25,000 a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they've ever used that. I was opposed to that allocation on an ongoing basis, and I think I felt that the administrative overhead was too high for administering the program. I didn't want it done by the board anymore. We didn't have a real good history of evaluating objectively and making those kinds of decisions to the degree I thought that we should. My concern was with the IVCDO being the charge is that it really has an Illinois Valley, I mean, it's in the title, and I'm not sure how many loans have been appropriated to other parts of the county. It was supposed to be an entire countywide program, And I'm sure I'm wrong, but it seemed like there was only one loan that was tangentially considered outside of the Illinois Valley out of the nine that I had seen. And so I just, for me, it's a struggle to endorse this moving forward. I think I'd like to see or hear a report. See a report would be great of where we are, what we've done, how many jobs have been created.
How many are still in place, too?
What the success rate has been, so how many are in place.
And these are loans, right? This is a loan program?
Loan, yeah. Mm-hmm. So
they do, you know, there is some information that they provided in here for you, and they do a report. They come in and they talk to you about how many loans they have approved. I think they do that annually. I don't think they do it twice a year. I think they just do it once a year. When we had discussed this in budget, the thought was don't give them any more money to loan. Let's pay our contribution to have them admin the loan, but not give them any additional loans, because there's still, I think, like $100,000 or $125,000 sitting in the fund that they could be loaning out. So rather than keep putting our money in there to sit there, stop that and just pay the admin dollars, and when they run low, then give them money.
Kind of like the So Ready loan program there. They scratch for people to, they got like $3 million in the So Ready loan program, just sitting there, waiting to lend out.
Right.
But there, you know, at the last meeting, they said, well, we really need to start trying to find somebody to borrow this money. And I think you're saying the same thing about the SBDC program, that they do have funds sitting there. Mm-hmm. So why should we give them more if they're not being utilized, if they're underutilized now?
Right, and so this year is, I think, the first year that we didn't give them any more money for, or
didn't
budget for.
We've only been doing this for 2 years, and we didn't give them all every allocation from last quarter. So,
right.
I mean, last year's quarters.
Last year, I think we said we'd give them $25,000 per quarter if they proved a need, and they weren't able to do that. So we didn't give them money to loan. But there's still the fact that somebody is administering that loan, and so that's what this does, is it covers SBDC staff who helps, you know, with business counseling, et cetera, and then $10,000 for the admin of the revolving loan fund program. So, but this
just sounded high. I mean, I don't know how many loans are outstanding even. What's the return? I think we need our report. If it's Kenny and Ron coming in and talking about, you know, what do they see the program's virtues of? I thought it was kind of like a pilot, too. It wasn't something that was going to just automatically go in perpetuity. I can see that if, you know, First Community Credit or Rogue and Evergreen, if they're making all of the appropriate loans and shoring up the difference, mm-hmm. that's what this money was supposed to be. Evergreen will loan me $50,000 for this, but I really need $65,000 in order to get to that point. Sure, we'll come in for $15,000 or whatever and make up the difference.
Is there any history? Can they say, we have $125,000 that we can lend out? Are we turning people away because they want more than that? Or, you know, because that may be why they're not, you know, that why they want more money, so they can have a bigger comfort and a little more out of it? And do they have, and they're 2 years old, or is the money coming back in, and how much do they have money coming back in?
Well,
payments from the loan.
What portion is 2 years old?
There was a limit on how much any individual person could borrow.
Okay.
What we do is, you know, if somebody wants a small amount, we refer them to the Illinois Valley, to the RLF program. And then if they want a larger amount, we refer them to Soretti. And it tends to work well that way. So, you know, about 25 and under for sure would go over to this revolving loan fund, maybe 50. But once you're above 50, you really should be looking at Soretti for a loan. And we're just trying to do that gap financing. We're just trying to do what the banks can't do to help them get the business started.
I'm just curious, because this says they've been doing this since 2010, so what started in 2 years ago? What's changed?
Our appropriation of this has only been for...
Got it. A
couple of years.
Yeah. So they've been doing the program longer. We just joined in 2 years ago? Because they have report in here going back to each year, how many business starts and new jobs and capital investment has been done since 2009.
You're looking at the Small Business Development Center jobs created, not just the RLF loan right there.
True. It has the business expansion and the SBDC listed.
Right. The RLF is not broken out into this one. But we can ask for, I can ask for those numbers and bring that back. Like I said, they do the annual report. I know they present it, but
this board, I don't think it's seen.
They came early in the year, but it wasn't a report necessarily of this is what we do. I mean, it wasn't a report. It was just this is, we're checking in, this is what we do. But that was, this came
kind of
in
like
in
an
June.
Orientation kind of for what the program was.
Yeah.
Well, I'm in favor of moving the SOREDI stuff forward, but I think let's just hold off on the SBDC and IBC.
So we get a report.
Okay. Revolving loan fund.
Okay.
Anything else?
No, that's
good.
It. Thanks.
Public Works. Thank you, Ms. Schmelzer. Report and recommendation for temporary road closure of Water Creek Road slide repair, transfer of jurisdiction over certain county roads located within the city limits of Grants Pass, Oregon, to the city of Grants Pass, scheduling public hearing and directing notice of hearing. Item number 3 is order number 2017-046 in the matter of the transfer of the county real property not used for county purposes to the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, and quitclaim deed. And item number 4 is order number 2017-047 in the matter of mitigating slide damage on Waters Creek Road at milepost 1.2 to 1.23, approving temporary road closure of roadway during repairs. I think Commissioner DeYoung's laptop is having issues, but we can probably proceed in the interim with
an
overview.
The map that's on there isn't not clear. It's just black anyway for them.
Yeah, we really need to work
on
that.
We need to work on something like that.
It's not transparent for people who are looking at this online, and I don't know how many people actually do, but if we could lighten those scanned map things or pictures when they send us pictures, they're just usually black.
Especially in the heavily forested
stuff.
And
I wouldn't mind just a regular old stick person map that just shows where we're talking about on that road that doesn't show all the trees and stuff. That's cool for here, but when it transfers to us, it's just black.
We can do both flavors. We could pull the one out of Puma Vista that just shows property lines with the colors for ownership or something.
That would be
right. And you could have side by side.
That'd be helpful.
They need to be grayscale, I think, is what it needs to be when it comes in. If it's just color, then it just doesn't work well.
It doesn't copy very well.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
So,
let's wait for Commissioner Morgan. Where did she go?
Sure.
Why?
I don't know. She was looking for your laptop.
The facility, is that even work, right?
Is that Waters Creek?
I think you were coming back.
No,
I'm out of here.
That was more a matter of just to kind of give you can get back to where you get 199 on the screen, just so they've got a sense of.
We're just waiting for a second, Commissioner Morgan, get stuff squared away.
The Waters Creek thing, I'm sorry, I thought was straightforward. I didn't.
Straightforward, $85,000, but it's straightforward. Others, yeah.
Actually, well, it's been months in the works. It's not. Yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
So I'd like to combine items 1 and 4 effectively, as they're dealing with the same thing, and they stand up noticed as two separate. So, as we've talked about for a while now, the Waters Creek slide was a result of the storm in January and everything else. It's a box canyon. It's tight, narrow road, and we've lost it on the one side. We had OBEC come out, do an evaluation of the area. They said it's cheaper to go back up into the hill as opposed to try and shore it up from the creek side. So we've got that moving forward. You saw the easement last week from the Harrises to get that additional width we need. And as you'll remember, this road is not dedicated right-of-way. It's presumptive rights, effectively. So we're only getting what we need to do that project. Bigger part of this, we also had them take a look at the whole road for a potential future application for that flat money, and I think the commissioners saw a letter with a petition from some of the folks out there concerned about that potential. Somewhat of a sidelight, but just so you know, my intent would be to proceed forward at least in looking at that application this fall. If we get the money, then the board can make a decision at that point to say we think this makes sense or we don't, but it wouldn't be appropriate for me to at least not explore that avenue as a future thing. But
now, the question that the one concern, I think her name is Bobby,
yep,
is that the road goes right down through her, splits her property.
Yep.
And if we widen it to 2-lane through there, she has nothing left.
Right.
So when you make that application, can you make the application removing her, that section through there?
We could certainly look at that. My recommendation would be we apply to fix the entire road and then scale it back as needed. So if the feds come back and say we've got $2 million potentially available stem to stern, and we say, you know what, there's residents that are concerned about this section, can we carve it off? But at least this, yeah.
Okay, I see what you're
from saying. The outset, say let's try for it all, and then we've got the option to decline the money later. But okay. It would be,
and then that option would rest here.
Correct.
Not with it. Is it an option that
we could decline the money? We're not committed if we get the grant.
Okay, if we get the grant, but we say, okay, after we get the grant, say, you know, we have to carve, we want to do this part, we want to delete that, do they say then the grant isn't good?
No, we could scale it back.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. All right. Yeah, that's the question I had.
So how this then ties back to this project was the geotech scoped this area. We've got a number in hand. Power is going to be about $7,000 to move. Our engineer's estimate for the project is about $72,000.
This is for the repair.
For the repair, right. So effectively it's cutting into that hillside to lay this thing back.
Do we have enough? Are the Harrises giving us enough land to do that or just enough?
Just enough.
Do we have, you know, do we have an agreement with them that if that slows off, we're going to need more? Or?
We didn't preempt. We do something. It's pretty hard, though. That's why the geotechs were there, and they took a look, and it's pretty solid. Pretty solid stuff. Yeah, it'll stand nearly straight up.
How do the residents get in and out of the? It's a single lane run, and we're closing it.
For the closure times, they will be on stuck effectively above it for those windows. So it's going to be closed 8 to noon, open for the noon hour, and then closed 1 to 5.
We're proposing an intermittent closure.
Right.
Now, in the event of an emergency, is it something they just move the equipment out of the way?
They could move equipment if they had to, yeah. It wouldn't be instantaneous, but yeah, it could be that, you know, they've demoed, there's 30 yards of the road, oh my goodness, somebody has a heart attack up above. They shove it aside quickly to get emergency vehicles in or out. Yeah, it's more a matter of leaving it open just slows them down by a factor of 2 probably.
Yeah.
So that would be the intent.
There's enough room to move up or down the road to get out of the way so cars can go through, but right where that spot is...
Yeah,
with equipment. There's just no
crossing by. And how long do you figure the project will last? 10 days.
The closure was just for the week. They think they can get it done. Yeah, in 5 days.
And then the people have been notified that this is coming, or not until we are involved are they getting notified?
And you've already sent a Coast Guard out to let them know what our intent, what we want to do.
Yeah, we signed the project last week.
We're gonna send another postcard later, letting them know.
I think there's only 2 or 3 people above that.
Yeah, we've heard from one above and one below, and just their initial concern was, oh my gosh, it's closed the whole time. What are we going to do? I said, no, it's open again at night. It's open during the... Right. So that was... They once they heard that.
There's just a handful of houses, but there's also BLM and Forest Service, so we're going to notify them as well.
Mm-hmm.
In case they're planning any kind of logging or... Who knows.
Sorry, was that all? Not likely.
Just saying.
So that was the intent of the closure. Any other questions on that one?
Nope, sounds good.
Okay.
Well, and I mean, people have the chance to get out early, come back at noon if they need to. It's not fun to be away from your house all day, but it's doable.
Right, and the alternative would be it fails, then you're away from your house for a month or more. So leaving it for another winter is not an option, unfortunately. Okay.
That's 1 and 4.
That is 1 and 4.
Is there any pedestrian activity able to go through there? Because I know what I would probably do is just, you know, if I needed to run somewhere, I'd park a car on the other side, but I'd want to be able to walk through or something. You guys will be able to facilitate.
We can certainly talk with the contractor about it. It may be a matter of saying, hey, hold on for a second, don't swing the bucket, you know, and have, you know, yes, effectively have somebody walk up. If it was, we wouldn't want to make it a regular thing, but if somebody said, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We would want somebody to walk them through that work zone because we don't usually like them going through a construction area.
Right, and there's not really an alternative. Yeah. Otherwise, you're at the creek.
Right.
Yeah,
but there will be width, yeah. We're not going to want them, they're not going to be excavating enough to where it's falling off the downhill side because then we're getting into the water and we've got other problems.
Well, I can see where it saves some money, too, because you don't have to have flaggers if the road's closed. You're not flagging it.
Yep.
So.
Right. And you've got the guy in the bucket looking over his shoulder. Oh, my goodness, is there a car?
Yeah.
It's much quicker this way.
Okay.
Second one is the county to city road transfer. I think the two of you have sat through these on the other end of them probably, and Commissioner Harris sat through at least one, if not two, of these in the past. Effectively, this is once county-maintained roads are brought to city standard and or were city standard but just had not been annexed in yet. We've got two lists in front of you here. One of them involves roads that are up to city standards, which are effectively just a straightforward transfer. The other list, Exhibit 2, are ones that are not at city standard, which typically means no curb, gutter, sidewalk. So associated with that is a payment that we make to the city of $9,000 a mile for each of 7 years. So effectively, we're looking at transferring about 3 miles, almost on the nose, that fall into that category. So this would encumber Public Works with about $27,000 a year for each of the next 7 years. The $9,000 a mile is a great deal for us. I know because I came up with that number about 16 years ago, and it hasn't changed. So, or 19 years ago. The city does get traffic impact fees for that area, which offsets some of that, but it obviously takes off, you know, between the two, almost 6 miles off of our maintenance area, and these are just roads that are a city road by all intents and purposes. So they're sweeping it with, you know, a pickup sweeper as opposed to a broom. They would be looking at asphalting these when they eventually need repairs as opposed to cracks, you know, chip sealing. They're just urban roads by any standard now.
I can't see any disadvantage to doing this now as opposed to waiting until our IGA is different. I don't foresee us negotiating a better rate than $9,000 a mile. Sounds pretty reasonable. So it's fully, you know, 7 years, $963,000, and you can't curb gutter sidewalk for $63,000 or anything.
We're taking bids. We're taking bids for about 1,000 feet of curb gutter sidewalk, and it's going to be $80,000.
I understand that. Just seems crazy.
Yeah, it's very expensive. Yeah. The other side of this is we've already been in contact with the city, and we've whittled this list down to what both sides agree to as far as which roads they would take and the mileage on them. So they're already prepared for this.
Tentatively agree.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great.
It's slowed down over the years. The first two transfers were on the order of 9 miles. 9 miles again about 6 years later. And then the next one, I think, was 5, and now we're down to 3. So it's kind of now down to what the city annexes and expands outward. I think this is probably going to be the usual we see now, maybe 3 to 6 miles every 6 years.
What I've found with curb gutters and sidewalks is everybody already wants them until they're going in front of their house and taking out that much lawn and stuff. So this transfers us. They're not talking to us about it. So no, it's a city.
Yeah, yeah.
It gets that monkey off our back.
And then that interface planning area has gotten far better, too. The percentage of roads that we're transferring that are already at city standards has continued to get higher and higher, just as the city anticipates the UGB going out and conditioning the curb gutter sidewalk at the time of construction. So it's definitely streamlined that process, too.
Yeah. One of the questions I had with the local contractor is, why is the sidewalk so thick? I mean, a road base is, you know, just a ribbon, frankly. The asphalt's like 3 or 4 inches, and it isn't. It's like 2.5. It's like, but your sidewalk, it's like
huge.
It's really, a lot of times, really thick.
Is there any wire in it? Mm-hmm. I don't know if they put wire in sidewalks or not.
They do under the driveways, but not necessarily just the sidewalk itself.
Maybe that's why it's a little bit thicker. And maybe you put wire in it and you can cut back on the amount of concrete.
You can.
Yeah. And concrete's far more brittle than asphalt is the other thing, too.
Right.
So you get alligator cracking in sidewalks. It's a lot different than little bit of alligator cracking.
Seemed interesting.
Yeah.
When they have to tear them up to do something, then, it's just like, well, that's not a small job.
It's a hunk.
Yeah.
And it's tough to get any concrete work right now.
Well, I don't see any objection to moving this forward. What is the process? I can't remember. I mean, does the city have to say we'll accept it? We send them a letter of saying,
Yes.
And they're in agreement with this already?
With this list. Tentative agreement to this list. We
signed. I'm curious which ones were on the list that they didn't agree to.
Well, there's a couple.
Did you sneak Beacon in?
We always put Beacon in like 2-point font. They noticed it, yeah.
No, we didn't do Beacon.
Beacon's not as big of a concern, frankly, for me as Fruitdale. And hopefully Fruitdale will be funded in these next couple of RBI cycles, because we're getting to a point of not doing the kind of maintenance that I think we should, because we hope that it's going to be conveyed. But if the gamble goes poorly, our cost of redoing what it will take to keep it up to is going to be more.
Yeah.
So they didn't actually do cement around that manhole. They did asphalt, mm-hmm. which begs the question, why did you wait? I've seen 3 other jobs that were going on around.
It was cold and raining last week, and we felt with the cold patch you wouldn't get a good product.
I didn't think that situation or the substitute was safe, so I'm not real stoked on that. It just seemed, when I came on it, I was like, well, this has to be some sort of emergency situation for this. I mean, it was not half of the lane, but real close to half of the lane was taken up.
Yeah, it straddled the fog line. Yeah.
No, it was 3-4 feet.
No, the manhole itself straddles the fog line, and then it's out into the travel line.
Well, the barricade, it's like you have to all out stop if there was somebody coming the other direction, and it just seemed not the safest way to do it. So I don't know what the criteria is for how much of the land's taken up before we have to do something different.
There's not going to be a hard and fast in terms of the MUTCD. I mean, there's enough width that folks on the eastbound lane should have been cheating over out into that extra recovery area.
You can't
had,
do two cars there.
It was
not safe.
Depending
not
on
safe.
The car, yeah. Right.
So, anyway.
To answer your question, we negotiated back and forth. We didn't know exactly where the annexation lines were. And we didn't know if it would have included an intersection or not, so which side of the right-of-way. So that was the negotiating back and forth as far as the length of the roads.
Great. The next item is, so we have to schedule a public hearing and hold that for the... Oh, you're talking about... Well, there's a transfer of real property, is that where we're at?
Number three, yeah. Elmer Nelson.
Yeah, that's the next one.
Okay.
Go ahead, I'll let you take that one.
Elmer Nelson is, that portion of Elmer Nelson, I should say, is city, a city street. There is a lot there. It was deeded to the county. I believe you guys...
I just want to point out to you, I just noticed your picture in your packet.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it?
Here's the picture we get.
Oh.
I can color it.
Well, you know what I did is, there you go. That's the one I sent.
No, I'm just saying that it doesn't scan.
Okay,
we got to do something different with that. That's just not it.
I didn't realize it was so dark. That's true. So as you see there, there's a resident that wants a portion of that. Obviously, the city street is in part of it. And my thought was, we'll transfer the whole thing to the city of Grants Pass. Let them decide how much they want to keep and how much they want to sell or give away.
So we own just this blue strip here?
Yeah, where the hatch is. Mm-hmm. It includes out into the street here.
And that takes it to, this is a property line here, these outside lines?
Exactly.
And then this is right away.
Right.
Correct. I think this person wants some piece of it down in here, is my understanding. I didn't want to give away too much, and then the city have to buy something back. So I would rather the city make that decision. By transferring this over to them, they can decide what to do with it.
Now,
it's a city street, so we don't have anything to do with it anymore anyway. It makes no sense for us to keep it.
No, but the cost that an individual is going to have to go through going through the city to try to get that from the city.
It looks like when they put Elmer Nelson in, did they do a half street improvement? Is that why that sidewalk?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
And when this would develop over here, that person would have to come out to here,
correct,
and do the rest of the other half.
That's generally whenever
kind of like
somebody develops this side.
Jordan Tweed was that way.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Exactly. So this is already developed. I don't.
Well, this person was already prepared to go to the city. That's where they started, and then somebody did research and found out it was county owned. And then they came to us.
Okay, so they're already dealing with the city.
Yes.
It's just a technicality that we end up owning it with ownership.
Right. And per the deed back in, was it 87? It was deeded to us.
Question. Where, I see the property line here, but is this the right-of-way line, or does the right-of-way actually go like for a utility easement inside that sidewalk? I guess it doesn't matter if we're going to give it away. What do I care?
Right, but it's kind of essentially it's a tax lot that comes out into the street now, just like it's drawn.
The edge of right-of-way is technically,
But since it's owned by the county, they went ahead and built the road.
So who are we giving the land up to? Are we giving it up to the homeowner?
We're giving it
to the city. Grant to the
we're
city.
Giving the whole thing to the city.
And the homeowner is prepared to go to talk to the city to get the piece that he wants.
You put a piece in there. The city can't make a profit off of it since we're giving it to him for free.
We didn't. But
good question.
I mean, seriously, the cost of getting those transfers and everything, person's going to have to pay a whole heck of a lot from the city where. Mm. We're giving it away for free?
We didn't pay anything for it. We got it for free.
Right.
I understand.
So I didn't even think about that part of it.
But for the, I mean, to me, the question would be is how much would the city charge that individual to get that when they got it for free?
I don't think they could show. I think they'd be under the same boat as us if it was acquired initially for free. I don't think the city could turn around and sell it for a profit. They could certainly charge whatever their permit fee is, but they can't
survey.
That's what I'm talking
they
about.
May
their fees
the surveys because they're going to have to split it.
They have to establish the right way for that road.
Possibly I'm not sure that there's any restriction on we can acquire anything we want by any means and sell it and charge whatever we want. So I don't think just because you get it for free. We've sold pieces of property that
if it was dedicated, we can't sell it, is my understanding.
So they're just conveying it.
Right.
Right.
That's different.
Right. And that's how we got it, by a warranty deed. So.
I have no objection to that.
It's fine. The only concern I would be is just the cost that it's going to go to that individual when. But.
Sure.
That's between the individual and the city of Grand Pass.
And I have no idea what they would.
Well, technically, it's not. We haven't given it to the city. We can arrange with that individual without the city's involvement, or we can give it to the city and say, work with that person.
Could we give it to the person and then have them deal with the city and then the city buy it back from them?
We could we give the individual the piece that he wanted. Is what we would.
I mean, you got a property line here. You convey that all, or you extend that out to here, and this one goes to this one, that one goes to that one. You're done.
The
city works it out with them when they want to expand.
We can tell. We could tell the city what do you want to retain from this piece, and we could certainly work directly with the property owner and convey that other piece to the city. It could be done that way. We just figured that it would be.
We could say whatever the property owner wants, we're going to give you that part and give the rest to the city.
We'd still have to coordinate with them in the city to see if the city had an interest in keeping it wider than that. I mean, effectively, they need to bite at this. It's their road.
But if we're giving pieces of it away, we would have to split it ourselves.
Right.
And that would be a process of our own that we'd have to go through.
And this will eventually end up going into the city anyway, so I think they need to call the shots off. And if the landowner is willing to work with the city, that's their deal over Cross Park Lot.
If you want, I mean, I could certainly talk to City Planning and get something in writing from them that says the projected piece of land would be conveyed at no cost to the individual. We could get some kind of an assurance like that if you want to do that.
To me, it doesn't seem that would be my preference. The city's getting something for free. They shouldn't turn around and charge for it.
We can get something in writing for them. Okay.
Great.
Would you be okay keeping this on the calendar, assuming I can get something in writing from them prior to business session?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. That's good.
I think that's it.
Public Works.
Okay. See you Wednesday.
Great. Mr. Streeter, up for item number 4 is quarterly department updates, forestry.
Morning, sir.
So I'll kind of run through some of the hot points that's been going on since my last quarterly update. We're currently working on our 2018 sale layout that we'll sell this coming spring, typically first to second week in April. Goal is for about $6 to $6.5 million target, similar to this last year's sale program. We have two laid out. Cruising will be done today on those so we can establish volumes on them. One is a regen harvest on Reeves Creek on out past the dump, and the other one is on Hog Creek, and we're also still working on some layout on some others. Once we start to kind of get a feel for the volumes on those, we can kind of get them all packaged together in a sale program like we want. My goal is to try and do 3 to 4 sales and not the 9 that I did when I first got here that were already laid out for me that I inherited. It's just efficiency-wise, it doesn't work very well for anybody. So that's kind of our goals right now and that we're shooting for. The markets are really good. We built a little piece of road on the top of Poor Man Creek, where we're having the issues with the neighbors. We've got a court case scheduled for the 17th and 18th where they blocked our access in there and had problems. We built a little tie-through road up there so that if we get an adverse judgment on us in that court case, or if we just choose not to go out that way anymore, we now have a second alternative route in, out of there. But
you have to have that. You have to have that access in play before it moves to court.
The court thing is over an existing easement that we have that they're blocking us, basically harassing us. They actually jumped up on the hood of Rick Kern's pickup.
We don't need to discuss too much of that.
No, we've been there.
Anyway, there was when we built that road, we had two loads of logs and actually marketed them yesterday at $800 a thousand delivered. So the markets are really good right now. So I'm optimistic about this spring when we do sell.
Well, I think actually that brings up a point about I'd like you to put this is just my recommendation. I don't know where the board is, sits on this, but the capacity. So we shoot for that 6 to 7 million board feet. And I do know that there's going to be, I would estimate that the local, that the national market for timber is going to be up just based on what the hurricane did down there. The number of people's homes that are going to, I mean, home rebuilding is going to be a substantial thing this next year, I would imagine, down in that area. And so I think timber prices are going to stay. That being said, who knows what it's going to be like. Canada could let go of a bunch of stuff and change all of that. But what I was hoping is that you have, you're shooting for that target of 6 to 7 million board feet a year. What was it, 5 to 6? It's around 6, right?
Yeah, 6 to 6.5.
Yeah. The idea that you could have, you know, some ability to appreciate an increase in the market price and, you know, maybe go outside of your... The challenge that I... What I see the BLM doing is their target is 38.5 million board feet a year, say in their ASQ. They never put up 40, 50, you know, to appreciate an up in the market, because in 2 years' time, when there is no need and the housing declines or whatever, and you really only want to put up 4, if we didn't take advantage of the up, you really almost can't afford to do the 4. You know what I mean? So
yep.
I think working on we've talked about, you know, anywhere between a 5 and 7 year, 10 year average. You need to go above it a couple of times when the market's better than we've seen. I remember seeing 8 and 9 when I was a kid. And so just trying to, is that something you can factor into?
Absolutely. I mean, you just...
I'd love to see you have an extra million.
You take advantage of a market today, you just got to pay the price down the road where you pull the program back.
We know
back
that it's going
bit.
To right. cycle.
Yeah.
But you can't plan. You can plan for not selling, but did you plan to sell more than outside of your average 2 years ago, 3 years ago, which would be next year, to take advantage? So I don't want
to
put
you... Have it ready to sell.
Have it ready to sell.
If the market's there... Have that extra inventory ready to sell and ready to go. I see what you're saying there.
Yeah.
And we actually have a couple of what I would call challenging sales that we've been looking at, and those are good ones to look at during
the
good
market.
Times.
Yes. Nobody wants to buy them. And
they may be more attractive during good times than
exactly.
they would be during bad times.
So, yeah, I'll...
However you want to achieve that, you know.
I will actually look at having some extra volume on the shelf.
Yeah.
And come trigger pulling time if it looks like markets are really good. We could even do our original sale program and follow it up a couple weeks later with another one if markets are really good, just to with the second offer.
Totally.
Just make sure that the present board, because this will probably transcend this board, make sure that... When you are selling off that reserve or whatever you want to call it, that, you know, this is temporary. Don't get used to this, because if it goes down, we're going to drop their offer.
Well, we don't see revenues immediately.
No.
And so it brings up a really good issue. I really need to get making sure that I finish the Josephine County Forest Practices Ordinance before I leave office. And this is one of those issues that gives him the latitude. And then the way the structure of the works out, his sales are 3 years, appreciating revenues throughout those potentially. But the board never sees anything more or anything less than our sustained trust payment, which is, you know, $600,000 a year. He could do $2 million worth of sales. We see $600,000 of revenue every year, but he could also not sell a thing for a year, and we get our $600,000 check. So that's the goal that I have. I hope that's the vision for this board.
Makes sense.
You're living off a trust fund that takes the pressure off of him, and it manages the asset to where values are up.
It gives you the latitude of when to sell and when not to if you've got a little bit sitting in there that you can ride out a couple of years when things are bad.
It's really him working more like a private sector. You know, he's got owners that want their lifestyle requires a check every year, and it needs to be that check or he feels some pressure. But it also, they don't get to take more. It's a trust fund.
And it's also important to have that direction from the board on what to do on the ground, because some of the public may not agree with that kind of a harvest program. So having that direction and a long-term direction is important to us, to say this is what we are supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and it's sustained yield. If I had a pen, I could illustrate that if you always just bump up against what you're looking to try to get to, but you come down sometimes, you have to go over sometimes to make up that trough. Otherwise, that sine curve doesn't actually work, and it's, you know, so
it goes both ways. Just to go to the extreme, we could sell $14 million in 1 year and zero in the next.
Right.
That's still the same thing in two-year average.
Yep. I think I want you to you're the expert. I want you to feel the latitude to be able to say, wow, I think we need to take advantage of this because we haven't seen this in a decade or more or something like that. The inventory question comes up. So if you're doing 10% of your inventory and you're selling 6 million board feet, does that factor into the 10%? Because that seems real easy that you know what you're going to get, you know, because you're going to start at zero with that in 3 years. Does that make sense? So if you needed to cover X number of acres, but you're putting up X, you know, half of that in a sale to where it is going to be inventory, does that count towards your inventory that you're covering every year?
Because
you are kind of inventorying it.
Yeah, so what we're doing with the ownership is we will, I try to scatter it all over the county, and I'll say, inventory this piece, inventory that piece, inventory this piece. The sale program may or may not coincide with that at all, and typically does not, because we tend to go to the more mature, older, higher volume per acre stands.
For the inventory?
For the timber sale program, to where the inventory could be anything from reprod, you know, newly grown stocking surveys to this to merch stands. So it's all across the whole board on the inventory.
Yeah, I just mean that you're actually getting an accounting. If you haven't done an inventory on the plot that you're putting up for sale, you are getting one.
You're cruising it.
But you're knowing after the sale what the volume per acre was, and you know, at the end of that sale, within years, you're going to start out at zero volume, and it resets, kind of, to speak. So
I've actually created a spreadsheet where I've got last year's sales, and it says how much we advertise, how much volume we advertised in that sale. And then I've got the beginning inventory. What did the inventory say
that was out there?
And then if we have volume remaining afterwards, how much is still remaining? So
you
take the initial minus the remaining, you have what the inventory said was on that site.
And then how
is that accurate to what we said was there, to what actually came off of that tract? And that gives me the ability to gauge how well we're cruising a stand. My goal is to always be within 10% of what we actually cut, but hopefully be minus 10%, within 0 to 10%. A little bit conservative. That way we're not writing checks back to purchasers. If it overruns a little bit, the purchaser's paying the county. Mm-hmm. That way it's always coming in and we're not having to refund the purchasers. That's my goal. And this will give us an ability to track how well is the inventory predicting the volumes on these tracks and how well are we cruising those tracks.
That's great.
On the timber side of it, we were fairly active this summer. We had upwards of 5 and 6 sales going. Everything went pretty smoothly other than one neighbor was not very happy on one sale, but all in all, everything went pretty smoothly. We also, another point that I have in my others is that we were lucky to get through the fire season without losing any ownership. We did have two that were close that I monitored. The Miller Complex was within about 2.5 miles of one of our sold sales. That would have been not fun to handle if it was something we'd actually
sold. What happens
to
that? Does it become a salvage? Do we have jurisdiction to say, yeah, go ahead and salvage log that if it did burn?
Yes.
That would be at a lower rate.
So basically we have a current timber sale, and I would think what would happen would a negotiation would have to take place. It would depend on the damage to the timber, obviously. If it was charred, it's almost unusable at that point for them. But hopefully you wouldn't get in a situation like that. But, you know, we'd have to probably enter negotiations, see if they're willing to go in and salvage.
Most of the value's still there. It's the, the outside, you know, there's a value to the bark when they bark it before it goes into the mill. And I heard there's no value to the bark, I guess, when it's charred like that. But the internal is pretty good if you can get on it in a quick order. I mean, I remember the Douglas Complex. Those people, they were literally hauling it out, and the logs, maybe it was just early in the morning, but they were steaming, you know. It was that quick after the fire was there. So, and I don't know
their goal.
They lost a lot of value.
To be in front of that and try to get that salvaged as quickly as possible. Private landowners would probably take the same position that we would and hopefully beat the feds to dumping a bunch of volume into the markets. And the ability to react to that quickly is hugely important.
We did a really great job after the Douglas Complex. I think it was about 1,100 acres rather than the 26 that went up.
And then Shan Creek, we had one that got within about 0.5 mile of our ownership on Shan Creek, but that got it contained. Both Forest Service, so there was some beads of sweat up here about how they were doing on those things, but they were able to get them under control, thank goodness. Back to the inventory, we did get an update for 2016, so the inventory is always lags a year behind, basically, of reality, but we cruised all last year, sent all that data to the contractor, told him the tracks that we had sold off, and then also the harvesting that had taken place with new cruises on that. So we've got a new inventory now. We're working off of that, and we continue to take our plots. We did a good job of catching up last year on our plots, and my guys that are doing the plots have targets now that will be part of their evaluations every year. I set targets for them to hit, and if they don't hit those targets, we want to talk about why and what we need to do to make sure that we do it. Because when I got here, it just kind of fell by the wayside. The last thing I want to do is get in the position the county was several years ago where the inventory goes stale.
Yeah, that's unacceptable that we'd had to spend, you know, we spent $103,000 on that contractor to get us up to back in the game.
We're really doing well. Like I said, that having those goals, and like I told the guys, I said, I don't want you necessarily overdoing those plots, because the goal is to do 10% every year so that in 10 years you're redoing the first 10%.
And that was my question about the 10%, is a portion of that could be considered in the sale process, you know, that we're going to do, you know, 8, but 2% was the $6 million board feet of volume that we put up for sale that is going to be accounted for exactly the volume. Yeah. Is that the case, or is that in addition to? So you're doing 10%, and maybe we're putting up 3% of our...
Yeah, there's definitely a percentage of our sales program that does fall into that inventory,
okay.
10%.
Yeah, that would make sense.
But they're different cruises.
Right.
They're not the same. We inventory a lot more information on an inventory cruise,
yeah,
than we would on a timber sale cruise. On a timber sale cruise, we're really interested in how much gross volume by species,
right. Right.
And how much net volume. You know, those are board feet. Mm-hmm. But we do... Like I said earlier, I do want to track what's the inventory telling me is there,
yeah,
versus what was really there.
Right.
And track
kinda
that
get
over
graded.
Time. And you use that as your rev limiter on your program. You can say, well, this thing's under-predicting or over-predicting. And there's other measurements that we also do through the course of the year to
You're
also
working within like the 85 percentile of what you expect, what sustained yield
correct
inventory is telling you. So we've... He's going to do this for 5 years?
About 5 years until we get, that would get us about half of the ownership inventoried, and then we'll have a lot more confidence in what
number.
The inventory's telling us, and then we can kind of fine-tune to what the sustained cut is.
Is there any merit to staying within your 85% inventory sustained yield and not going outside of that? Is there an argument to say, no, I don't want to put up 7 or 8 million board feet because I'm still not sure, I'm still working within that 85 percentile, and if I do that, that throws off my average, or I don't know how you not
well
really.
All you're doing by staying in the by 85%, we're only cutting 85% of what it's telling us. Now we're not going over that,
yeah,
it's not plus or minus the
15%. And you would do that in a 5 year, so
yeah,
it would
so
equal out.
So we're if the tree farm is doing what the program is predicting, then we're putting volume in the bank right now.
Right,
it's still going to be available in the 5 years. Once
and, that, and that's where you would get your additional if you had a good year, right?
You could.
I mean, you're still not getting close.
You could. He's going to find
you
out in 5 years whether or not he's
pushing
right
over
on
the limit on the 85, but. Guess what? That's the time to maybe take.
I think
a little
he's
bit
staying.
Out
I think he's staying within his 85. Is what? That's kind of what I was asking. Are you staying within your 85 by doing more because he's going to do less the next year? But it's going to be, you know, 85 says 6 million board feet. He's going to stay that way. So
yeah,
if he does 9 this year, he's only doing 3 somewhere in the average. But
so
then you're still putting 15% away.
And 5 years from now, that's all grown back up, and you're back to even anyway, right?
Mm.
Or
not in 5
no,
years.
That 15% will be banked every year.
It's just
and it's compounding.
Growth.
It's also compounding interest, if you think about it that way.
Yeah.
The 15% that grows 4% every year isn't 15%. It gets complicated. But
it's it actually slows down over time. If you let a tree grow
there's a
longer,
depreciation.
It starts to flatten off.
Starts growing. Yeah,
they're like humans.
That,
right?
Stops growing up and starts growing
they
out.
They get old and they blow their knees
yet.
Out.
Yep. I'll let you know when I plateau.
But just to really quickly, so the 6.5 is only 85% of the predicted cut right now.
Okay.
So that's our what we're shooting for right now. And the reason behind that is over the 5 year time frame, we want to make sure that allowable cut is accurate before we go up to it.
Okay.
The one thing I didn't want to do is go right up to it and then
find out
it was too high.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden you've got to cut off for several years right. to get back down to that. So to me it was better to wait and know and then go up to it. If that makes sense.
Yep.
Grants, we still have an application in with FEMA for some fuels projects on about 6 of our tracks up against urban areas. We just got word this week that passed another hurdle within FEMA, and at this point it's going to environmental review. The gal from the state is optimistic that it should go through that fairly easily, but nothing with this FEMA grant has gone easily. It's been a very painful process, and as brought me to tears several times dealing with it, unfortunately. But if we get the money, I think we can do some good work doing fuel breaks in and amongst homes and urban areas along some of our tracks. So it's one of those things that I think it'll work out well if it ever happens. But
too bad the Firewise money couldn't go towards that.
You know, and some of it is in those areas, but the Firewise goes to the private folks that are adjacent to us. But yeah, I think we can do some good things if it ever gets done, but I'm 2 years into it now, and I'm just like... Also, we received about $19,000 on Title II, and that was for our youth tree plant through the BLM, and we just finished improving the road into Stringer Gap, put basically $17,000 worth of rock and made a super highway for buses to get in there. We were having issues with buses showing up and not coming in to the parking area, and all those kids were having to walk all the way back in there and created just a huge traffic jam. So that should help us out a bunch out there, and then we're going to use a little bit more of it for some other supplies that we need for that and not come out of our budget. The youth tree plant is scheduled for the 8th, 9th, and 10th of February. So if you can put that on your calendars if you'd like to come out. I'm sure the weather will be nice and rainy.
February can be pretty nice. So
but the kids show up in their shorts and their tennis shoes, swimming in the water and the mud and have a good time. Never bothered them one bit. We'll have around 1,000 youth planting about 4,000 seedlings in those, primarily in 2 days, Thursday and Friday, and then Saturdays, typically some of the clubs that come in on Saturday. Silviculture, we planted about 250,000 seedlings this last spring, January, February, out into March. Bad news is we're getting poor results of survival in the burn. We're investigating why right now. We don't know if it's weather related. We had a good spring, but then the long dry spell we had in the summertime may have tipped some of those seedlings over. The bad news is we may have to invest some more money into some of those tracks to get them up to snuff.
Dave, I really want you to evaluate the efficacy long term of planting in the spring. I know that people like to, but I just don't. We don't have a capacity to water, and that's the thing. Is I think this isn't. This is going to continue from my perspective. The I don't believe in global warming, but I know that climate change is probably something that's here. I remember growing up as a kid, the seasonal creek used to run almost year round, and then it didn't. Now it cuts off in June, and it, you know, it's just, it's really dry. I planted a couple hundred trees at the ranch 2-3 years ago, and they would, none of them would have survived had I not watered them. And I know it's, the terrain's different, and the slope matters and all that sort of stuff. We just need to be really strategic about, is there any benefit to planting? In the fall, seems like they get a chance to winter and have an earlier opportunity to root in the spring starting, I don't know. It just feels like there's maybe a little bit of a degree of positive by doing it in the fall.
There's been a lot of look into that.
Okay.
We're doing basically the same thing that the private folks do.
Okay.
Typically, the fall planting takes place in areas of high elevation where you'll get snow, and sometimes snow doesn't come off till June or July, and then it, by then it's too late. Well, you're planting a dead tree then. So optimally, harden the tree. You know, the trees will slow down September, October, put them into dormancy, get them cold, get them in the ground, give them a couple months to acclimate, build some root mass and whatnot, and then grow through the summer, hopefully. We think this is an issue with either some of the site prep that was done out there, possibly, or the stock, the seedlings themselves. Rick sent an email to the nursery, Cal Forest, when we initially got the seedlings that indicated he didn't think they had got hardened off enough before they were pulled. So we may have an issue with that. we're not sure. We're communicating with the other landowners
yeah.
to see if they've had issues, especially ones that use the same nursery that mm-hmm. we do.
It's expensive.
It is, but I think we can all agree it's in our best interest to have a
There's no
growing forest. So.
Question about reforesting. I mean, we're required and required to have a certain stocking level. What's the Oregon State Forest Practices Act? You have got a
175 per acre.
Yeah,
and we don't consider it stocked at that. We typically shoot for 300 or 400
right.
per acre. So we're doing stocking surveys now. This is some of the preliminary information
yeah.
we're getting, and we'll be making determinations on, you know, what's our stocking percentage? Do we have good coverage over the ground? And some of these we may say we're in a good spot. We're okay with this because ultimately when they get to be harvest stage anyway, you're only talking 150 trees per acre
right.
anyway. So we're going to be looking at these individually, looking to see if there's any trends in the stock, you know, mm-hmm. where they are. Is it south? Is it north slope? Is it a stock issue? Is it site prep issue? What's going
yeah.
on here?
Yeah. Well, Rick's going
to we're not in favor of continuing to dump money into this ground any more than anybody else, but unfortunately, we got to get this stuff up to snuff.
You mentioned all those things, but you know some of our ground isn't the most prime ground, and so this is probably an occupational hazard, and maybe I just need to understand that no, this isn't the highest quality. You're gonna have to put more in the ground to get where you're at. If you wanna be at 200, you might have to put 250 or 3 because
yeah.
you're gonna get that's how
mortality.
You get to
yeah and yeah it's. It's challenging. You kind of want to. You don't want to just turn your back and say, "Well, we got to replant it." You want to try and figure out, you know,
can we do
what
better?
Went wrong. Yeah,
that's
did
the only
we
reason,
do something wrong?
That's the only reason I asked that question yeah. about fall planting.
Yeah, and it costs money. It takes time. So we want to do it right the first time mm-hmm. and go away from these things and let them heal up. But
well, there was some questions yesterday at the weekly business session about application by the BLM of certain. They've got a 20-year plan of 1,500 acres of application, which sounds like a lot, but it's really a small portion of what they should probably be doing if they were harvesting more. And that's the critical point is everything adds up. If you're not doing site prep, when he says site prep, it's like deciduous tree removal, kind of getting all of those competing elements out of the way so that the things that you put in the ground have the best chance of survival, that they're not having to compete with other stuff that has a huge root infrastructure or is more predisposed to taking off real quick and grabbing all the sunlight, and then our trees are left with nothing left. And I don't know.
Well, I see we're planting you. When you plant it's really important. For instance, down in the city park, they said, oh, look at that. All the trees blew over. But all those bull pines, you look at the root wad, there was no taproot on it because guess why? The water's right there year-round. And if you plant in February, it gives them 3 or 4 months of rainwater to establish a root system. And then as the water goes away, that root system can go seek water. I think you can have a better product. I don't have any problem with February.
Yeah.
But I don't know where you need a longer time for that root wad to get established. And then when the rain goes away in spring, it can take off and go.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things with the seedlings.
Fall versus spring.
Yeah, root ratio. You know, you want a good root ratio to tree. You don't want a little bitty root system in a great big tree.
No, they got to be almost equal.
Yeah, it can't feed it. You know,
yeah.
it'll have a hard time.
Well, that's where the drip line of the trees. Came from a riverside park because the water coming off the drip line, the root system goes out to get that water.
Yeah.
But I, you know, our contention is you continue to water that tree, it's not going to build a root system. It builds a root system for a purpose. If there's no purpose, it doesn't. Mother Nature doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
I use the analogy of a coyote chasing a rabbit. You watch him, and then all of a sudden, it's like somebody hits him in the back of the head, and the coyote goes, somebody says, you know, if you catch that rabbit, you're not going to renew, you're not going to recover all the energy you used catching it. And he'll stop. Rabbit goes away, coyote goes off to do something else. And the trees are, I think, the exact same thing. They're not going to go build a root system seeking something that's already right there. It'd be like me going to the store to get a beer at halftime when I have a whole refrigerator full. Doesn't make any sense.
Unless you think you're going to run out. Yeah, it's tricky, you know, and we do our contract on the nursery, you know, we know what size the container root system is going to be, and then there's you know, classifications on the top of the tree caliper and height and everything that we want them to shoot for.
Could it be as something as simple as that when people are planting, they're not planting it deep enough, or?
Yeah, we do plant. That could be a problem. You know, maybe they're grabbing a whole handful and stuffing them under a root wad or something like that. But we're following them around and we're doing quality checks on the planters all the time. And then their pay is based off of that quality. If they get down below a 90% check, we'll basically send them home, you know. So if they're hitting that 95% plus on a quality plant check, then they'll continue to plant and give feedback on any errors that we're seeing. But
I just had a question if you get close to the end. I keep hearing traffic on the emails about Pickett Creek. We're not involved in any of that, are we? That Pickett Creek sale?
No, that's beyond.
That's beyond. Okay, that's beyond.
Some of that does come through our road systems and mm-hmm. stuff, but
I've asked Burkhardt to come in and give us a review of the Pickett Creek sale. It's a real important deal, and I think a lot of the criticisms are probably unfounded. It's what has been worked on for over a decade to try to get to a landscape-based management. The problem with doing all these pilot projects at a couple hundred acres is that's what people think the force, the BLM should be operating at. No, it should be a 6,000-acre you know, project, kind of a landscape deal, mm-hmm. and there's little things in that. So I think she needs to come in and kind of give us an overview and allow us to kind of help carry some water for them, I think, on some of the elements of it, not all of it.
Couple other items that I have. So everybody knows our BLM reciprocal got put into place. We signed that. I'm working on the large industrial landowners, and I was working with Tom Hayes from Indian Hill originally. I was going to kind of establish an outline for it, but then Indian Hill got bought up by Hancock, and Tom hasn't been working on that anymore. So I figured out that it wasn't going to get done unless I did it, so I'm working on getting that mm-hmm. in Word right now, getting it typed in, and then once I have that available, I'm going to give it to Wally to review, and then start going to these large industrial landowners to solidify our access through those folks before those lands continue to change hands. And also on my docket is to try and review our timber sale contract. It's been a lot of years since that thing's been modified or updated, so I'm going to go through that and kind of bring it up to speed with where our program is
today. One of the important considerations that Dave brought to my attention, I think he's brought it to the board, is the change order style stuff that needs to happen usually on a pretty timely basis and doesn't mean a whole lot. So if the full board signs it, any amendment needs to be signed by the full board. I don't object to the full board signing these contracts. They make a lot of sense, and I think we need to, but at the same time, he needs to have the discretion in the contract to say up to a certain threshold, probably his contract signing authority and his allocation authority of $10,000 and maybe even the liaison up to $25,000 for some of these deals where something changes over 3 years and the contractor wants to work in a dynamic fashion on the ground. Can't wait for 2 or 3 weeks of our process to see that reflection in the contract. So I totally endorse moving in that direction a little bit more and giving him the authority to act as the manager to facilitate these contracts after the bulk elements have been agreed upon.
I think, Dave, you've shown yourself to be a very competent and good manager, and I would trust that as well. So.
Yeah, and all I'm asking for is basically the same latitude that the other directors have in their departments. I'm not looking for anything more than that. It's just to give you an example, I have two extensions for time requests from two contractors right now. So I can't do that. Any modification to the contract, I have to bring it to you, and all three of you have to sign it. So it's kind of...
We get those from other departments, too.
Yeah.
For contracts extensions, we've had to do it for the courthouse, we've had to do it for the airport. So that's...
But we've also delegated for public health to do those amendments.
Mm.
So we make exceptions.
So we've had a little latitude.
Because public health had, where was 1 year, I saw 37 different amendments to the state contract in almost a year.
Wow.
And so, you know, that got incredibly cumbersome with low dollar elements and no real, it's a state contract, of course we're going to be fine with it, because usually it meant more money. But allocating more time and situations is fine.
I think the biggest modification that I've had since I've been here has been around $1,000 on a contract, and that was for a mistake that I actually made, omitting a purchaser credit that should have been in the contract. Mm-hmm. And I admitted it out of the contract, so I had to amend it back in.
Yeah, that's fine.
And the other thing is dealing with extensions of time, as long as it doesn't exceed a year or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I feel like everything else is in order, then I can extend the contract a year, as long as it doesn't change the payment structure of the contract.
Yeah. There's so many things that you that are out of your control that would affect that contract.
I cannot do anything on that contract other than administer it.
Right. But I mean, like for an extension or something?
I can't do it.
You can't do it.
I cannot do it. Mm-hmm. If it deals with time or money, I cannot do it.
And one of the important considerations is we have fewer and fewer purchasers these days. And so we just need to make sure that they feel accommodated, that, I like buying the county sales because they're not, you know, they accommodate certain challenges and stuff comes up and... I just need a couple more months on this deal, and I'll get it done. But if we're sticklers and hard and fast, then he knows, you know, he wants these people to come back and purchase next year. So he's got the on the ground experience, and I'm 100% in favor of that amendment style to the contracts, and we can accommodate that for sure.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
That's all I have, unless you guys have some questions you want to throw at me.
That's it. I think you're doing fine. I thought we had more of those private sector reciprocal agreements on the books, and it was a BLM outstanding element.
I thought so, too.
Unfortunately, we had one, and it was with Spalding. However,
well, their holdings are not.
We chose not to record it, so it's as useful as the paper it was written on.
Yeah.
And Spalding has sold lands since then that now we can't go back to the new landowner and go, well, I've got this document that says I can use your roads.
Okay.
It's a really unfortunate situation to be in, but my goal is to try and get it rectified as soon as I can.
I think the positive is that they need to use our roads, too.
Yes.
So it works both ways, and I think everybody wants to be cooperative. The players that owned these properties 2 years ago, a year ago, were more local, and I know that there's one of the purchasers is a lot different than it used to be. It used to be able to have public access on Plum Creek. Wasn't it Plum Creek? And now they're saying they're putting up gates and not allowing any kind of
interaction. That's all warehouse.
Warehouser's got a different attitude.
Yeah. And it's really just protecting our access long term and not be changing as the ownership changes. Once that's in place and recorded, we legally can use their roads, they can legally use our roads.
I thought these purchases were more in a long-term fashion, but what I just saw in the last 2 years with Hancock selling 50,000 acres to Murphy Company and then buying Indian Hills 50,000 acres or whatever 2 years later, it seems more like a car exchange rather than a long-term land investment. And I guess that's what I'm seeing is when these companies that have multiple capital assets in their portfolio, they treat it like anything else. You know, they dump it when it's convenient and they need the cash, and they buy it right back the next year when they want that long-term
and most
element
of,
in their portfolio.
Most of the industrial landowners are fine, like you said before. You know, they need our roads as much as we need theirs, and we've got good working relationships with those folks. And usually, all they have to do is go and ask.
Yeah.
But it would be better not to have to go and ask every time. Mm-hmm. And if that company decided to surplus land because it didn't fit into their management scheme, so they got this 160 that happens to sit right next to us, and they sell it to Joe Pot Farmer, now I got to go and ask Joe Pot Farmer to get through his ground, and maybe he's not so friendly to harvesting.
We don't want to have you doing that.
My goal is to protect those rights.
Is there any on the private sector long term, and this is probably a legal question we should ask off the record, but I don't think it's rocket science as far as using a right of way through private sector does grant some rights as far as access is concerned. If you can prove that you've been using a road for, I think it's 7 years, they can't legally stop you from the continued use of that.
Yeah, I know there are historical use rights out there, but that would be a question.
Who wants to
for
prove
all.
That?
Yeah, it's
challenging.
You know, it goes more $20,000.
Yeah, fighting that in court as opposed to just saying.
My goal is to get along with everybody up front. And
right.
Get rid of that.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, thanks, Dave.
Yep.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nothing further? Good deal.
Good deal.
Finance report and business update. We've got Arthur O'Hare. Nothing listed on the calendar, but we are going through our fee schedule update like we do annually. We do address fees just twice a year, but dominantly once a year so that they're implemented January 1 for whatever kind of changes. Just builds in so our clients know, our constituents, what the fees are going to be. We do clean up in June. If there is anything that, we should have adjusted this one and we didn't, we can do that in June, but those are rare occasions. I think we've only done that a couple times since I've been here.
Well, that was the first thing on my list was the fee change
steal
reminder.
Steal your thunder, burst your bubble, and
it was off.
Cookie or
but,
crumble.
But my question is, I've only heard back from I've sent out a couple emails to remind folks we're doing this, and I've heard back from a couple of departments, no, nothing for us. I haven't heard positive. Parks had a couple questions on
they are
some
proposing
things.
Some fee changes.
Okay.
So
I have a couple
those.
Questions into legal on the, like the resale items when they go and buy ice, for example. Can they fluctuate the price of their resale items, or do they have to set a fee for ice even though the price of ice might fluctuate up and down, you know, given any point of time in the year? So that's a legal question I have. I also sent another question to legal to regarding the public health transfer, and I brought this up, I believe, with a few folks on the transferring the clinical programs and the fees that we charge for clinical. Typically, we go through a fee process for that, the county is, but I think our charter also mentions that even if we transfer programs generically, that we cannot circumvent the right of the voter to establish fees. So that's another question I have into legal, whether if we transfer the clinical programs to a third party, whether they will still have to go through a fee process to, you know, change what they're charging for our delegated programs. So that's that. The other couple of things I have is things that came up this week. I do have a mental health grant that the state sent to us. It was delayed by the state, and it's a $131,000 continuation grant for existing programs. I'll bring it in next Thursday. It's an IGA, so there's really no problem with retroapplying that thing retroactively. Hugo Hills, I got an email yesterday that apparently Hugo Hills had a few awards that were not CDBG grants, but were awards from the mental health division, not the Oregon Housing Division. We paid off the bonds to Oregon Housing, but apparently there were some awards for remodeling of Hugo Hills. And with those awards, there was a 30-year
good night
obligation. Yeah, it was, and that's from back from 1995, 1996. So the mental health division of the state of Oregon is saying that if we have ceased using Hugo Hills, we're going to have to pay back a proportionate share of those awards. And it looks like that's around $70,000 for...
So then that should be passed on to options. Who is the one who chose to move out of there, not us?
Yeah, it was, and actually I talked with Carla, and she said, you know, let me know, but they would be willing to either pay up front, you know, half and half, however, because we're still kind of dealing with mental health, saying, isn't 30 years kind of excessive for a, you know, they gave us an award to do a remodel back in 95, and now they've got a 30-year amortization on that.
You would have done it again. You're still paying... like putting your washer and dryer on your home mortgage.
Yeah, but it's kind of the idea of negotiating the contract 20 years later. If it wasn't good today, you shouldn't have signed it 20 years ago. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's when the conversation
happened.
Well,
yeah, it's coming to us.
So the interesting thing is that...
I think options will have to weigh in on that. I'm not...
Yeah.
You know.
And Carla already said that she'd be willing to do whatever we felt was the...
Is any of that like for HVAC equipment that's depreciated or anything?
I'm not even sure. I heard hide in her hair. There was nothing in the file on that. This is stuff that's 25 years old.
And it's something that options, was it our agreement or was it options?
No, back in 1995 it would have been run by us, run by the county. So we gave this, the county ran this.
We ran it.
Back in
options 95. Took it over.
Right.
So they may not have even known about that element.
They took it over in, 2006?
But they're moving is what caused it to be...
Yeah, and so there's probably mutual culpable responsibility here. I wonder, you know, it's not a transferable thing because the asset is with the property.
And it's the building.
It's not like
it was
the intent to move somewhere else so you can transfer the depreciation to someplace that's going to need to... that won't work that way.
So if the group that toured on Monday wants it, I wonder if they would meet that obligation.
I think that's too early to talk about that, but it is a factor of, well, let's not pay it off until we have a negotiation about put something else in there.
And I'm going to work with them, because if it's ceasing to be used for the purpose for which it was originally.
How much was the grant in the first place? That $70,000 on a 30-year schedule is still
well,
they had, must have been.
This was
we're
from
25 years into
the mental health division. Of the state of Oregon, the 1995 it was to remodel renovation.
My apologies,
$142,000 was the 1995 award. $69,000 in 1996, and then they had a $30,000 in the year 2000.
No offense, 20 years into a 30-year thing, and they still want to charge you 50%.
So this is just something that came up yesterday afternoon. I was working on it a little bit this morning, and
it's early. We'll figure it out.
It's early, and I'll try to. My whole thing is, you know, a normal federal grant, like a CDBG grant, is a 5-year obligation. You have to continue to use the equipment or the property for 5 years. That seems reasonable, but to have an award and say that for the next 30 years you're obligated, that seems excessive. So I don't know if this is federal or whether it's just state, but like I told Carla, hey, the general obligation, elderly low-income bonds, we paid those off, and they theoretically were obligations for 30 years, but we refinanced and we paid them off. So maybe something of that nature can occur here too, because this is just... I would think they could just forgive it as much as anything else. There's no payback. I mean, there's no...
It's funny. I wonder if the program even still exists that you would be paying it back to who, to what?
To who?
What entities?
Still
there? Where the money comes
from? No collateral. Then. What are you going to do? People paying off the wall?
I was going to say, what are they going to
do? Nothing. What are you going to do?
And there's nothing... I mean, there's been no communication with them for 20 years. So
it's still really early in this process, so I wouldn't jump to that.
I just brought it to... I wanted to bring it to your attention. And then I also want to bring to your attention that I do have an annual conference October 9th, so Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday up in Portland for the annual conference. Sandy will be here. I'm not letting her go so that we can have somebody in the office.
The auditors coming in October, don't they usually?
Auditors will be here. I'm not sure what the date is, though, but yes, they are coming in. They're It might be later October. Mm-hmm. Might be the 1st of November. I'm not sure. I don't remember.
And then October is when we're doing the twice. We're implementing the bi-monthly payroll.
Yes, correct. Our last monthly payroll will be next week, a week from tomorrow. That will be October 6th. But Friday will be the normal monthly payroll. And then the month of October is biweekly. So the first 2 weeks of October will be paid on October 24th. So no more draws, no more middle of the month draws for folks. They'll get paid on the 24th. Everybody will. That seems to be going fine. We're testing things and working through the different steps. I've had several people comment on the transition assistance offer and how grateful they are that the board was able to offer that to them to transition into the monthly, from monthly to biweekly.
Still boggles my mind that people are getting paid more often. I mean,
yeah.
Less pay. You're going to see less money coming to you in a month than you are right now.
Well, yeah, because it's only 2 weeks.
Yeah, you pay more often.
Cumulatively in the month, it'll be
less. Are you saying that the tax schedule is different for...
No, I'm saying that you have currently 12 paychecks, mm-hmm. and so your total year payment is divided by 12. Now that total year payment is divided by 26, and so technically it's 13 months worth of payments. So your monthly total that you see will be less. Your overall year will be the same, but your monthly total, and since we're at the end of the year, it's going to be the last 3 months. You're bringing in less a month.
Well, no, I think what's happening is people are drawing an arbitrary line right at the 7th. You know, our normal payday is at the 7th, and at the 7th, I'll have less money. And that's true. But on November 24th, you're going to have more money because you're getting paid on the 24th, 14 days later from the 21st, 14 days later, you're going to get paid again. So if you draw
the
line,
two amounts together.
If you draw the line at November 21st, you're money ahead. Okay. You're 53 hours ahead of where you would have been had you just been paid once a month.
I was just going off of what you said in an email that it will be, and that was why we talked about it in the first place.
Right, and so what people are doing is they're saying, well, on the 7th, but on the 21st, you're way ahead. And on December 5th, your next payday, you're like 160 hours ahead of where you would have been. So, I mean, and at the end of the year, December 31st, actually with the December 19th payroll, you will earn more money than you would have earned. You'll have more money, and actually you'll have more on your W-2 than you would have had you just been paid on a monthly basis.
So that's different than what you had in your email.
Not really, no. The timing of the cash flow is where people are kind of, they haven't sat down and figured
it
out.
It is a change.
It's a change.
They'll get used to it eventually. Right now, it's going to be a little bit of a challenge if you're used to getting paid once.
And I think most people are like experiential. So when they get that check, then they'll say, oh, that's what we're talking about.
In business, when I got done paying everybody, and I had $15,000 in my checking account, my first question to myself was, who did you forget to pay? Because that isn't your $15,000.
Something. So it is a change, and I think people are justifiably a little bit, uncertain. And so I think it was appropriate to say, look, we can extend this olive branch offer to help alleviate some of those concerns.
Back to the fee schedule.
Yes.
So
fee schedule.
It's important that every liaison be able to defend. Because I don't necessarily, when I'm going to go challenge, I don't know that I'm challenging the manager. I will challenge both of you to say, why is this fee where it is? And you need to be, so the manager should be going to each of their liaisons to say, this is what I'm proposing. Are you comfortable with it? Because if you're not comfortable with it, then I'm probably pretty sure I don't want to see it.
Can you let us know if any of our, if the Fairgrounds comes with, in answer to your email, Fairgrounds comes in with something, be nice if I knew about it.
And that's what I haven't heard yet, other than Parks. Parks has been communicating with me.
And we went over to our Parks Advisory Board.
But, so I will send out another email reminding folks that you need to talk with your liaison. If you're going to have any fee changes, you need to talk with your liaison.
Having said that, I have the hardest lift with building and safety and planning, so challenge away. And if I can't defend it, that won't be such a bad thing.
Yeah.
We need to evaluate those. I don't like the lot line adjustments and stuff like that costing $2,000 or whatever they cost. It seems like it needs to be a scaled approach to it. Some are easy, some are crazy complicated, but they all need to happen.
And no offense, I mean, to me, that came up earlier this year. Is people buy a property, they don't know that the stuff on it's not permitted until after they bought the property.
See, I don't know about that.
I've heard that from multiple people.
No, I totally hear it, but I don't care.
But you have something too close.
You buy a car and the transmission doesn't work, that's your job.
But what I'm saying is, instead of them getting a permit for a building, they're requiring people to do lot line adjustments that cost $2,000 or blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So instead, they take the building down. Hey, no lot line adjustment. Well, now you need to file a deed restriction. Why are we causing people to pay so much money to do things?
Yeah.
Again, it's that lawful but awful. So.
I've got, and just a couple of, I'm still working with Food and Friends. There's some more contractual back and forth that we're dealing with and with legal. And the Dimmick, I'm working with Moll Foster and Seth on finalizing some of the DEQ issues with Dimmick.
When do we expect a scope of work and a draft RFP for the North Valley Industrial
Park? Good question. I talked with Seth on that. This week, we sent the preliminary engineering report to Seth from Rob Brandis to so he could do a better assessment of where we're at and then how much work needs to be done. I'm asking him just to give us project administration, not doing any of the work in the engineering sense or whatever, just project administration.
Yes.
Give us an idea of what we're looking at.
But can you say that again? I'm just kidding. And that's great. I think that's the element, the chink in the armor that's been lacking for decades.
Yeah, so I'm hopeful that we'll be getting something within a week or so of that blue sky is what I asked. I'm just giving you a blue sky statement of work and what you think it might cost to do project administration. So well on the way of that.
Excellent.
That's why I was bringing forward.
Well, to keep you in the loop, I'm meeting with the board gave approval to put together an ad hoc group to look at a recommendation to the board on how to use the funds from the sale of the Cape Junction property.
Oh, okay. Right.
And but I need an expenses
on the
HVAC, 340 HVAC and Michael's, whatever it is, a little bit of money advertising or whatever his administrative costs. It's not the 10%. I don't think the board endorsed the idea of $34,000 coming right off the top to Mr. Watson's office. But there is an appropriate administrative amount that should be subtracted from the cost of the sale of that property that should go.
Well, the caution I said it yesterday is that they're well aware of what we sold that property for. And if we just keep whittling around the house down to $230,000 and the rest of it went to admin.
Yeah.
I gotta like that.
I think my expectation is that the HVAC system costs $33,000 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It should be depreciated, and it should be the remaining of the 5 years because it isn't fully. So it's not going to be $35,000. They're going to get well over the $300,000 threshold. It's a majority of it. And the press release did say minus expenses. They need to be justifiable and defensible, and they will be, So I think the majority of it's going to go.
Just a caution from this commissioner.
Okay. Well, nothing's free that we do here, so it's got to somebody's got to pay freight on these elements. And
well,
not assigning it to one undermines, I think, our ability to assign it to all. So,
I think your normal cost of a realtor is anywhere from the 3%, half and half, up to the 6% standard fee and depreciated.
Those are typical
HVAC
for one-time transactions with one client.
Yeah.
Mr. Watson facilitates 60-70 transactions for us and appreciates 10% of those. So there is a negotiation. I would imagine if you had a retainer, a realtor on retainer, he doesn't get 3% on everyone because you're his only client.
Oh, yeah.
So
true.
I can argue both sides. He does a great job, deserves 10%, but that's not what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Arthur. Anything else?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Cool. Item number 7, board business. Oh, but let's we'll go and deal with item number 1, Assistant County Council 1 and 2 job descriptions. So move to the end of the agenda. That's the thing in red I didn't see, so that's awesome. I think red's a really good color to write it in.
Well, and we do appreciate the board's flexibility.
Oh, absolutely, no problem.
So this is a continuation of Tuesday's discussion. We got that kicked off, and I think we're just kind of taking a couple days to think about it.
I mentioned it yesterday. I took an ordinance code enforcement tour with Julie and Denise, and I did mention it to her. I don't know how much she's been brought into the conversation. Arthur, do you mind coming up? Because there's a capacity to pay within the planning office's budget that's a consideration for adding this one position. And, I think that's part of the conversation that might need to be happen next is,
sure.
A, is that a good idea? She thought it was a great idea.
Okay.
And B, what's that going to cost me on a regular annual basis? Do I have a capacity to pay for that every year if it's $50,000? And it's not in her budget right now. So those are the considerations that she had that I think are a pretty important conversation to have before we say, yeah, let's do this.
Okay.
I certainly think the amount of work that she's going to be providing to you guys is not going away. So, and I think she was pretty excited about having a land use expert on staff to do those kinds of things. It's going to help everybody because even her new staff or herself and stuff, there's things they don't know about the legalities and a lot of questions on a daily basis for your office. And rather than having somebody that knows the answer to that, you guys oftentimes have to kind of look it up.
Yes, we do.
And
you lose something when you bounce back and forth. And if you have somebody targeted to that,
yes.
A heart surgeon doesn't have to worry about your sprained ankle or whatnot. He's worried about your heart. And there's a lot in the legal side, I think, that applies there.
Yes.
Especially in land use.
Yes.
That's where you're going to get in
instead
trouble,
of a specialty.
More often than not.
Mm-hmm.
So those are just the considerations that I thought needed to be. But are there others? You guys need to. Other elements you want to weigh in on? Commissioner Young and Morgan.
So when this was brought up Tuesday to now, I guess, what were we looking for today versus?
What I just did. What are the other considerations that need to be done before we said yes to this and put it on a weekly business session?
Yeah.
I brought a couple. Do you have any?
Well, I still am wondering about having the same level for the clerk's position as far as can a lower level do the clerk and a full-time do the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes to the capacity to pay and where it would come from kind of stuff.
Yes.
So
yes.
I don't know that 2 days would have given enough time to look at that.
I think we talked about it. Said if you're going to give us more, that'd be great. I mean,
we'll keep them occupied.
Have a full-time attorney, and then
the money will.
And then go back to the law librarian as just a law librarian, and not have them be a clerk, but just keep the library open half a day, kind of thing.
So is that what we're looking at in the bottom line? I mean, ideally, if everything else falls into place, we'd have a full-time legal counsel one, and a part-time law clerk or law librarian.
Well, I don't know that you could use them both.
Or would we go back to a full-time law librarian, law clerk person plus a full-time?
That's what I didn't know. I didn't mean that it had to be necessarily a part-time because there's also research that person does in a librarian capacity or clerk capacity.
But then you're putting the money up.
How are you paying for it?
Yep.
Exactly.
But
the one side has a solution. Planning's paying for it because they're the client.
Yep.
They're using way more services of legal than they're paying for.
Yes.
But that person can be a full-time position.
No.
Okay.
That's a separating out the part-time that's paid for and the part-time that planning's paying for. At least that's how I understood how it was.
Okay.
I think we need a schematic to decide who's paying for what and how it's
paid. See, we're already paying for a part-time.
Right.
Yes.
And we have part-time paid by the state.
Yes, yes.
So I don't see why that should change, except we need another attorney. Mm-hmm. So you're saying take the part-time from this one and give part-time to planning?
Planning can't pay for a full-time attorney.
Okay.
No.
Let's talk the actual numbers for a moment, just to get on the same page, and Arthur can correct me inevitably when it needs to happen. But so essentially, the Assistant County Council one is going to be, I think, a few thousand dollars more annually than what is currently budgeted in the ISF for Beecher, because he exactly. So to the extent that we're talking about this year, realistically, it might not be any this year. You're talking about the roll-up costs, however, going forward into the coming years, that would be the burden of planning to cover. As the position gets more seniority, picks up steps along the way, then yes, planning is going to need to budget in the, you know, call it 5-10 years going ahead for the roll-up
There's
costs.
A funding stream from the law library.
Yes,
that
yes.
Accounts for that. And that's not going to be coming into planning to do what they want done. So.
Yes, yes. You know, for whatever it's worth, the funding stream does go down, it seems, every biennium for the law library. I mean, every year since 2011, it's been going down.
Yes,
from the
but
state.
We have a pretty big carry forward.
That too is true.
It's dedicated, so the money carry forward about $50,000 every year.
I think it is
something like that.
Yeah, yeah, scale. Sure.
Look, right.
So
now.
Potentially that position could still remain and be paid for, and then the portion we're paying for partially, and then planning paid the other half for a full time position.
It would be the same position, except it would be filled out by a lawyer, is really the way to look at it.
No, I was looking at two positions.
Yeah,
oh,
if
two
you look
positions,
at two positions, it's how you fill it out.
If we talked about two positions, we have talked about it from a money point of view. If you went back and said, well, we're just going to have somebody filling the position of a librarian, keeping it open half a day, which currently it's only open half a day, and that position could be hired in. They wouldn't have to be a lawyer.
No.
And so, but then the money for the other, for the lawyer that we would hire, wouldn't be coming from the state at all. Because they wouldn't have, and then we'd need to find a spot for them to actually be.
And that's the one where the suggestion is, more or less half and half. The half that's currently coming out of the ISF legal counsel department would pay for that piece, and then the differential that used to be paid by law library will now be picked up by planning.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. You could do that part-time clerk or something, and the full-time.
But you were proposing a full-time person, and the question
potentially
was, where does the money come to pay for it? And that's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you certainly need it, because there's a research component. Yeah.
That
I guess that lot full-time lawyer's going to be doing. It sounds expensive to paying a lawyer to do legal
research
that we lose maybe by the library.
And having
legal
a lawyer,
research.
What's the $50,000 forward every
librarian's
year?
Still doing that?
That's what lawyers do, is legal research. So I mean,
yeah, but
I'm not being smart. I'm just saying.
No, I know, but there are. You can do a lot of.
Research,
Beecher did research. He signed off on it.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
But technically,
he wasn't
the law
paid very much. It was 11. It was a position.
Yes,
so,
and when he started, he was
it.
Working through the library, because it used to be part of the library back then.
Yeah.
And it was an AFSCME position. And we looked, it was like an A10. It was very, I mean, because it was staffed by people, like if he wasn't there, they'd bring someone over from the library. It was more of an actual librarian position. But also back then, there were more books than we've sort of changed now, more of it as electronic research. So you'd have to have somebody that, whether they were a paralegal, somebody with a JD or whatever, whoever
worried about
hired.
The library. I'm not worried about that at all.
And
I'm
that's
worried
the
about
thing,
the capacity in your office to still do the research and not be paying, you know, a lawyer to be doing it when it was, I mean, it was an 11 that we're doing it right now. Who's doing it for you guys?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's
yes.
where we
yeah.
need still that element. And they're going to be still doing that while they're at the library? Because I felt like Beecher, he did some of it out of the money that we were getting from the library, but most of his research time should have been assigned to the what we were paying him in addition to what the state was providing for.
Yes.
So right. Okay. So
if we
remove this and we give this portion that we're paying for and we give it over to a lawyer and planning makes up the difference, who's doing that this portion that I think Commissioner Walker was talking about? Damn it.
I'm not sure we look very much alike.
You don't at all.
Morgan was advocating for, we need to shore up this law library person to continue. Yeah, you better scratch that out. I'm not here for very much longer, but I tell you what. So, yeah, just keep it right. You know what I mean? We need that.
Sure,
you guys need
sure.
that. So let's keep it. This needs to be kept whole in the current way it is. If you choose to say that that person doesn't have to be an attorney or have a law degree, whatever kind of level you're saying, but we're adding this, but you don't have the funds to pay for it. So where are those coming from?
So you, it sounds like you're advocating what Lily was saying. It's like
she's or restating how what
she's
I was
asking. She was advocating. Yes, I'm asking the question. Where's the money coming?
I know. And like we know that the first year because Vitrude reached the top. So
yeah, it's going to be.
It's going to be.
And,
yeah.
It's the roll up going forward. What I'm saying. Right. The growth.
But you're saying basically a 1.5 FTE. Right now, 1.5 FTE, if planning picks up the difference, is no harm, no foul on your budget. And the theory would be that we would continue to have no harm, no foul on your budget.
And
it
is
pick up the budget as we move
forward.
That's
fine.
The differential there.
We're saying 1.5?
Well,
but see, in my opinion is that 1.5 is not enough for the work that's going to be done.
Yeah.
Is that we need a 2.
Can I piggyback on that for a minute? There's something I've neglected to mention, but I did want to mention at some point, which is that the legislature has just changed the public records request deadlines on us, and that is very labor-intensive, I'm here to tell you. It is very labor-intensive from attorneys.
Well,
and
I'm
so
okay with
maybe the 0.5 that you get for a law librarian needs
to be
all day long.
Well, then you're back to the law clerk. So, I mean,
In
a perfect world, you'd fill the position that we have open right now as a law clerk, and that law clerk would be working for legal half
full
the day.
Time.
No.
Well,
no.
Right. Yeah, and then you have an
half
attorney.
Half is in the clerk,
and then you hire an attorney.
It sounds like that's worth it.
That's how it's paid for, half from the law library side. The other half,
they're not paying for it. They can wait.
Well, tell me about building safety. Right now, building safety pays for part of the ordinance administrator, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been talking that they were willing to pick up a larger piece
as
things move and the requirements. So would the land use person have any overlap with building safety? By chance?
If I may, I would suggest yes, because what is being proposed to be added to the RLDC is a standard of building safety compliance. In the ordinance that's been proposed and that you've asked me to pull out the non-controversial stuff, I mean, that's probably one of the non-controversial items, but the way I'm reading it, yes, you would start seeing a planning violation as a consequence of being out of compliance with building safety standards. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so we would start seeing planning prosecutions for being out of compliance with those standards of building safety. So, yeah, I would probably wrap that in with the land use attorney's role.
I'm not saying, no, I don't like your plan. I'm saying I think we need more. And how do we get there?
Yeah, I don't want to just get to today's needs when you know what's coming tomorrow.
And we're not there right now. We're 1,000 complaints below in planning and public records requests and everything.
I mean, that's an important thing, but I will never reference the 1,000 because maybe only 20 of them actually meet the criteria that we've established as health and safety. Could be all based on fences and aesthetics.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We don't know because they're not inventoried.
So
the 1,000, that's a different topic that needs to be inventoried.
The other consideration is that if Leah's portfolio is 30% planning issues right now, or yours.
Mm.
If you no longer have that, where is the capacity creation there?
It frees her up. Yeah.
Frees her up.
Oh, it does.
So then you
really maybe only need the part-time person up in the law library.
Exactly.
Go back to just
that's,
keep it open.
Sure. That's what I was coming back to.
Yeah.
It isn't everything staying the same. So it's really a holistic approach that does take time and probably so, Commissioner Morgan, more than 2 days of thought.
Should we run some numbers, maybe?
I wouldn't mind seeing it pretty clearly delineated of where we're going to go.
Yeah.
That's what Julie's going to want to know.
Yeah.
That the real big consideration for both building and safety and planning is their revenue cycles are cyclical. They're doing really, really well right now, and it's a good thing to say, hey, let's just spend a bunch of money. The other thing is what does their reserve need to look like for this function specifically, that we don't have the luxury of being able to hire and fire a lawyer as the revenues see fit. The workload's always going to be there because people are always going to be issuing complaints and stuff and having challenges. So we need to, there needs to be like a reserve set up for this so that she can do 3 years in advance of whatever the projected costs are going to be. And that's the numbers that we're going to need to give her to say, yeah, I can do that. I can build it into the next 3 years kind of budget style. Mm. So I think that's from my standpoint what we're going
to do. I like that because it's a building. If building drops off, you're still feeling those complaints. Mm. You know, it might take 3 years to settle something.
And building and safety is one of those that used to have a really healthy reserve. Mm-hmm. In the last 3-4 years, they've been, and they're building it back up. But, you know, it just, all of those things are considerations for me before I say, yep, let's go forth and advertise. And one of the considerations is how do we advertise? I mean, the differences in the nuances of what we're looking to do. Let's do the back stuff on the numbers and structure, but does the job not really change that much as far as the description? And my point being is that you can advertise for what you're looking for, and we can refine this other stuff. I hate everything being in a parallel fashion of like you have to get everything in a line, and then you do it. Well, we know this is defined, so do it now, and the numbers and everything will coalesce with it. And if they don't, nothing lost. We're doing that in a couple of different situations where we're working out the back stuff
simultaneously.
That's just me. Not a lot of people can be comfortable that it's all going to work out. And so I can hear hesitation. That's fine. But I don't want to wait too long
stuff.
Maybe next week we take another look at this and we'll have it done. And then we're putting out a job description for exactly what we're looking for and what we can fund.
We do need to define how we can fund it. But for me, I think we have enough work that we need a full-time additional and the clerk. If that clerk is part-time because you freed up enough for the other to have more time, great. And we can do a part-time clerk and see what that would look like.
Is it a clerk or is it a law librarian?
Law librarian.
It's a law clerk.
Law clerk.
The way that it sits right now, it's a law clerk. But if we were going to use that person to do legal work for legal counsel's office, then it could go back to being what it had been 15 years ago, which was essentially a librarian, somebody to open up the law library for patrons.
There's so many nuances, not too terribly many. It's pretty easy.
I think you've got plenty of work to keep two people busy. That's the main thing. How you divvy up their day and how it's going to get paid, that's up, what's up for grabs. But
right.
You need to leverage the grant. Because if we're not leveraging the law library's funding stream,
then it's got to come from somewhere else.
Then it should go to somebody else. You know what I mean? You need to take that revenue stream, and even if they aren't, it's a portion of something, or it means nothing to us anymore. And it's a taker as opposed to a benefit to having that dual funding stream. Does that make sense?
Well, that's happened the way it did 15 years ago.
And I think. Morgan's point. We need to work to that end. Because otherwise we can give this law library position to the library and they can do it. It's not bringing anything to the table for us. But
giving it to them doesn't do your office any good at all.
It wouldn't be a difference if they were just keeping the library open. It's that they're doing something in addition to it and we're able to get a full picture. Then it's an asset.
Well, sure. In other words, you're taking the librarian and making it work while they're there.
I just like the idea of keeping that position and adding the attorney. Okay. I'm not saying no to the attorney. We have to figure out how to fund it. We have to figure out what to do. But I know we need the attorney.
Yeah.
We just need to figure out these details of how we fund it.
So this is a cumbersome process. I appreciate legal being patient with us. Let's revisit this next week. I mean, you kind of have to be, right? I know. That's a real joy, huh? So we've got Larry, apparently, who's going to be with us on Tuesday, October 3rd. But otherwise, I think that's the time.
For general?
Yeah.
Okay.
9 a.m.
Let's add it.
Without objection, that's normal. We need JJ.
probably here at this one too.
Yeah, he's out this week. He's been out a couple days. That's why somebody was there yesterday.
Somebody from HR just to track on what we're doing.
In the meantime, so should we work some numbers, get a couple of models going? Okay. Okay. Well, maybe. Exactly.
You can.
About three scenarios or so.
Cool.
And we'll come up with something for you.
Great. All right. Anything else while you're on the schedule?
Nothing comes to mind.
Something that came up during the forestry's deal is there's a hearing on the 17th and 18th. I would imagine of October.
Wow.
Yeah. I'd like to know about those as much as possible.
Yeah, okay, sure.
I think we may have mentioned it, but it needs to be an agenda item on a schedule where I don't hear about it tangentially to the four other things I brought you or you brought me.
Okay.
As liaison, I want to know as much as I can about these things and be involved as much as I can. So that's just me. And I'm going to try to put it on my schedule to attend that and stuff. So these are our guys we're talking about, and I want to know. That's it for me. Anything else? Great.
Thank you both.
Okay.
Okay. So
all three of you.
Board business. There's one element that we need to. I'd like permission from the board. We've already talked about this, but putting a resolution on next weekly business session for requiring legal counsel to codify the code by mid-October, some date. I understand there's about 20 minutes, an hour's worth left of work to get it to a point where it's in a package.
Okay.
And so I'll draft that today. Got a little bit of time, and it's simple, a couple of sentences. So
I'm just looking at that we're at October. I mean, Sunday is October, so they have 2 weeks to get that 20 hours done?
Sure.
You're okay with that?
Yeah, I think so.
It will be.
Right? So, item number A is Oregon Military Department Office of Emergency Management, Emergency Management Performance Grant, CFDA number 97.042, amendment number 1. Sarah would like me to sign this today. Is what I read and read.
There's an additional grant available of about $4,500 and another match of $4,500. It looks like a change of about $9,000.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. That's okay. I guess to sign it, I'd need a motion to approve the CDFA number 97.042.
I'll move to make that motion.
Amendment number 1. It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Seeing none.
No.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries 3-0. The next one is item number B, Resolution 2017-046, in the matter of an appointment to the Illinois Valley Airport Advisory Board. How are you doing?
Good. We have 4 vacancies right now. And so one of the recommendations, we have 3 recommendations. John Pappas, Aaron Beckard, and Cedric Scheiber all have been actively involved in would have the recommendation of the manager and myself. John Pappas would fill the economic development slot, and Aaron Beckard can fill the, he's a tenant and a user of the airport, and Cedric's is just at large. We're still missing the Chamber of Commerce permission position.
Mm-hmm.
But I would recommend we move forward with these recommendations.
Sounds great. Without objection, Commissioner DeYoung.
I'm fine with me.
State of the county. Oh, right. Talking item number 7C. We've discussed this a little bit beforehand and just need, you know, kind of an endorsement of, do you want to do it this year? Do you want to do it in January? I was thinking about it the last couple of days, and I think that every manager should have a couple of minutes to speak about their program. Veterans, parks, airport, everybody should have at least 5 minutes, depending on, you know, but certainly the sheriff and juvenile detention having a dominant amount of time to speak at this kind of a deal. But does this sound good? I could put together a preliminary agenda. Do you have
a recommendation on a time of year. I'd like it to be an annual event that the board, future boards, just adopts, and it might even be something that we as a board codify in ordinance to say that the Board of Commissioners will require everyone to come forward, and we can do this, and you will provide an annual report to the in the effort to be as transparent as possible for the services that the county provides to the public. Every January, every November, we will have a presentation of the county.
I like the idea that it's January, that it's not, I mean, it's at the start of the second half of the fiscal year. It's when other State of the Unions happen, of sorts, but it also isn't interfering with elections in November. So people might see something as political.
Right, as elections come holidays.
And the holidays and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So,
yeah, January kind of came to me as maybe a more appropriate
January's
time.
Probably correct.
I was trying to get it done this year, but January sounds good.
Yeah.
So that we give people, obviously, a bunch of notice. It needs to move along. It doesn't need to be a half a day. You know, an hour and a half, 2 hours, that's it. And so.
Well, I just felt we got, when you couple it with the city, we got shortchanged last year.
We
I
have
mean,
never...
Their public safety thing went on, and I didn't get to speak. I was just sitting there, and I just walked, you know, we were done.
You guys should have been introduced. You know, we've never not been shortchanged.
Yep.
So I think what I would recommend is that we invite the realtors to come to that.
Mm-hmm.
That should just be the city's. Let the city do what they want to do. They like to spend a lot of time on public works projects. Let them do that. I thought it was incredible.
They've got enough on their plate to explain coming up in the next year.
Yeah.
They're going to have to take the whole time to explain all the stuff all the balls they have in the air.
Right.
It's going to take them a while. So, and they've got issues over there that we've already settled. So I think the state of the county is going to be altogether different than the state of the city.
It is. And I expect it to be really well organized, very timely, PowerPoint presentations that are, you know, no more than 10 slides. Real quick, you know, that we're all professionals in our function and do a really great, succinct job of hitting the high points.
We did a couple of them. The mayor and I and a commissioner was there, because I can't remember who it was. But like Kurt Heater, he had for his board of realtors, maybe, I don't know what he did, but it was out at the Bear Hotel, and we did a couple of them that were just... And then this last year was the big one, you know, in council chambers. I don't know if they rolled those all into one and said, we're only going to do one in the council chambers or what.
Yeah, I don't know.
I
Gerard
don't know
has organized that one ever since I've been on the board.
Who has?
Gerard Fitzgerald.
Okay. All right.
So I've done that one almost every year.
Wow.
I haven't told Gerard yet, but nah, I'm not. I've prepared several times. Hours and hours going into a presentation for what I thought I got my 15 minutes, you know, and scrap it every time, which is really, really frustrating. So, matters from commissioners. Commissioner Morgan, sometimes Walker, whoever
Apparently.
She wants to be. Sorry about that.
AKA.
We are. I added to the agenda yesterday just the RR5, the next steps to this afternoon's agenda, so it's not listed here, but it was posted in time.
I think it was our intent to address it.
Correct.
But I also expected to get more of feedback, I think input from the cannabis advisory panel. So
I thought Valerie's point was the most thought through, and she actually came up with recommendations that she emailed the group. She looked at the article. She went to the code as a whole, and she had 7 years as a planner with Josephine County. So this is her background.
Right.
And her recommendation was the home occupied. So for somebody who is an actual OLC grower to come up with a recommendation that they add scrutiny and they add, I thought it was a very thoughtful recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, I just wanted you to know that it is on the afternoon agenda as well. It's in the calendar as there, it just didn't make it on this, and that's
like valuable.
I don't know how much I'm going to be able to, you know, I think I've said a lot of what I already felt. I need the Cannabis Advisory Committee to probably
now we need to listen.
Weigh in on a couple of deals.
Well, so let's talk about it this afternoon because we both all are going to have a lot to say, and instead of getting into it now, we can get into it then.
Do you mind? Is that in your wheelhouse from public health? The blue zones? I think it's taking place right now. Ms. Hoover brought that to my attention, and you know, I think we're only tangentially involved with that. We're not spearheading it, obviously, but they are looking for community partners. I know that Klamath County is really leaning into the effort. I don't know how much of a... It's not in my wheelhouse to be.
The board had previously... I had asked if I would be the liaison, or not liaison, but kind of the blue zone person earlier, and I'd met with Klamath and Hood counties at the WIR over it. But so previously I had asked about it, but that was when... before changes in our public health department, I had been asked to be on the steering committee, and I gave them an out if they didn't want me to be on that because of just kind of the transitions. And I haven't heard back from them as far as that goes. But I am familiar with it. I've been keeping up to date with it, so I'm happy to continue as part of public health.
Great.
If you would like.
I think it's in that arena.
Okay.
Anything else?
I would just maybe respond to her and let her know that I'll be the point person and she can contact me.
I'll do that.
Okay.
We'll soon find out if there's any trouble there.
Anything else, Commissioner Morgan?
No.
I have a couple of things. So I think it's really important that I put down on paper why I spoke to the planning department yesterday, the director, and she's opposed to the construction excise tax too. She just says it doesn't fit into my wheelhouse, but what I'm trying to do, you know, is try to three steps forward and then four steps back with it. Raffenberg apparently didn't sign the last IGA. That it's discretionary, that a commissioner, one commissioner can choose not to. I still think it's within the board's authority, regardless of what the ORSs say, that we choose not to. And I know that it's drawing a line in the sand pretty significantly, but it's kind of like what I, and I've only advocated from my position. I didn't say board is going to do this or whatever for the litigation effort going forward, but I'm tired of just being that scapegoat, that person that just people rely on because that's the way it's always been. And they don't come to the table and help our advocacy, and we don't go to theirs necessarily to help for their advocacy. I won't be a proponent, or I'll be neutral on this bond proposal of $155 million for their reconstruction. Do they need it? Absolutely. They need new schools. But who's looking at the price tag? That just seems ridiculous. Where are they spending this money? And they don't come to the table to negotiate these things in ways to make our economy here locally improve. The county used to give $1 million to each of the school districts back in the heyday, but they're the same people who are teaching, you know, eco-extreme positions of save every bird and every blah, blah, blah. You know what? This is what it looks like when you are not managing and we don't have an alternative revenue stream for it. So my answer is no, and I don't know how you're going to...
Can we tie this to their graduation rate somehow? Their graduation rate in Josephine County is horrible, and yet you just keep throwing the money and it doesn't get any better.
Well, different school boards. If you look at our two school boards, we have several new members on the Three Rivers that are getting in there and getting into their positions and figuring out how to see to turn things around. Grants Pass School District has longevity like no other school district. And are their graduation rates different or not? So would we want somebody coming in here and saying, hey, county, you're not doing blah, 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 blah.
They do every day on everything we do.
These school districts, these board members. So I just say we need to have the conversation with them. And
that's our concern.
Yes, but we didn't ask them what our rate should be for the last levy. We didn't ask them what...
We did on the levy, the three back that I wrote that has the school officers element. Is that something you guys are interested in? Absolutely. We would love that component. I reached out to two of his predecessors, and I apologize that that was the first conversation I had with the superintendent about it. But it certainly was not the first conversation. We can look at the agenda, the schedules, and I have proof that I was out there, and I didn't. that was the agenda item number one every time I met with any superintendent was the construction excise tax. And so that they didn't know it just means that it's an example to me that it wasn't an issue for them, you know, and it hasn't been. I haven't seen anything as a reaction. It's just not to say that I don't value what the school boards are doing, the difficult job that the superintendent has with, you know, less money, more challenges, higher wages, all of that stuff. I don't disagree with that stuff. It's that that the county place to assess this fee for construction, which directly benefits the local economy, either home or business especially, it just doesn't feel like the right move.
So maybe we need to talk to our legislative delegation, because it's a state law that took out the
discretionary
portion to it. So maybe that's the next thing, is inviting Senator Berziger and Representative Wilson Stark and Brock Smith in here, and Hurd. We kind of forget that he represents part of our county.
That's on my list.
And so I would suggest that maybe that's the next conversation of what that's doing to us, because
I look at it very akin to its system development charges in the city side. They just kept up until they finally they were part of the reason it broke the back and went from 328 building permits down to 8 within 24 months. And you go to city staff and you say, you know, why don't you back that off and try to save, you know, level it up? Oh, no, we're not part of the problem. And they were.
Right.
And we had a long conversation with Mr. Black about that until we finally had to do some pretty drastic measures. And I'm not opposed to saying, as construction ramps up, you ramp up with it. You don't wait till it's way up here and then pile on, because you'll be the one that crests the wave.
Yeah.
So I'm not.
They aren't piling on. For 10 years, they kept it stagnant.
Yes.
And they've gone up incrementally. They could go to the excess. They didn't. So I would say that they've been very conservative.
I think they've been.
That.
Yeah. From that aspect, they haven't been saying, okay, we're, you know, they haven't given it the assistant city manager outlook. Boy, let's just get it to them. Let's just run it to them.
Well, and I think part of it, too, they've heard that we would like to be a part of those discussions. So I would
agree with that.
Guess that if they have those conversations in the future, we're going to be invited to those board meetings or notified when those board meetings happen. They all said they would do a half sheet to have the information. So it's clear that when it says that fee's there, that they're giving the information right there of where that money's going to and why it's being. So they're going to share some of the burden of, yeah, this is us that's asking for it. But it doesn't change the fact that we are, as a home rule, we get a say, show me where I can't do something. Well, the state law came back and said, this is where you can't. You have to collect this fee. And I respect your right to be able to vote.
Councillor Hicks said, well, it's everybody's right, not just mine. So you're making a conscious decision. For him to say that the state is saying, well, you're going to facilitate public information requests now in 5 days' time, that day, whatever. Okay, well, yeah, where's the resources to accommodate those kinds of things? And it's not, they just do it. And I feel very little consultation. I'm not on the governance committee for AOC, but they have all the resources in the world. They pay themselves first in every situation, and then if there's anything left. I'm a little jaded from a standpoint that they keep making all of these laws and regulations, and I'm not so sure they're checking in to see whether or not that works, and maybe the proposal absolutely works for us, but that there isn't a local discretion. I mean, we answer to these people quicker than any legislator does. We want to facilitate those things in a timely fashion. For the state to tell us that you have to do it by blah, 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 I would much rather them say that you have to adopt a local standard for addressing
whatever fits
freedom of freedom of information. You need a policy. Done. Totally agree with that, state, rather than you telling me that I'm going to do it by blah, blah, blah. I don't know. There's not enough legislators who have been former commissioners, in my opinion. Thank you, David Brock-Smith, and, well, Kevin Cameron isn't there anymore, but Senator...
Hamill?
Yeah.
Harrell. Whatever, yeah.
Whatever his name is.
Hamill. So,
really great guy.
He spoke at our county college Friday.
Yeah.
Hamlin?
I think it was Hamill.
Hamill.
It was E-L at the end. I just didn't
Bill.
Know
what
the, Bill, yeah.
Well, this might be. Well, no, there is Hansel.
Hansel, there we go.
Hansel. Yeah.
I knew the first letter and the last letter,
yeah,
but not much else.
Well, he's got great things to say about pace yourself. Don't try to do too much. That's what he said to our group, and I'm pretty sure he probably has the same message. He was the longest serving commissioner when he retired. Maybe not more than Doug Roberts. I think he did 30 years, 31. Doug had done 33 when he retired. Doug Roberts. Those are the longest serving ever. Anything else? Larry, I hope, is working on some sort of getting a contractor, a review of an engineer, a hydro on the fire suppression system. I really expect the IV's, this ad hoc group that Kate Dwyer is kind of heading up, that I'm going to meet with, I think, tomorrow. Either this Friday or next Friday, on a recommendation, getting a ballpark figure about, A, what's wrong, B, what's it going to cost, so that they can say, okay, we want to do that one for sure. Now, what's left over? What are we dealing with? Do we have $200,000, or is it going to eat up? Is it going to be $300,000 for a fire suppression reservoir? I think that's the number they're going to want to know right away.
And that's not determined yet? That's
no, we've never really...
Okay.
I've never seen one. Maybe Larry has. It might be something that's on a shelf somewhere that he can just pull off that needs to be dusted off. But
okay.
Rob apparently had somebody he could recommend for a hydro engineer. So Larry and Rob just need to talk about, get that guy on site for 10 minutes, say, this is what you need to do. I'll write it up. That's going to cost you $115,000. Okay, so now we know... We've got $200,000 to do something with. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I forwarded you an email that I received from one of the department heads when I was asking for information. And essentially, it was them saying, we're not going to give that information. And I don't really think it was the appropriate response, but I'm not the liaison to that department.
I don't remember seeing that. So I'll take another look through and...
Okay. It was just asking what the fence regulations are on grows and stuff like that. And I assume with them doing all the codes and different stuff that they have that information. But I didn't want to respond back with saying, if I'm asking you for information, you need to give me this information without kind of touching base with you. So
no,
I'm just...
That sounds like a reasonable request. And
Going back to what Mark Collier said about categorizing out of the 1,000 complaints we have, is there one portion that everybody's talking about? And I'll bet you that fences, if you do that. If you do that math, it's fences. How do we go to the state and tell them that that's not working for our scenic value and our scenic asset here in Southern Oregon? It's not anywhere else. It's just here. That fence requirement is just really got people fired up. So it's from the state is going to have to back clear off and say, do it according to what you, to take that fence requirement back to county level. Because we're the ones that have to live next to it, around it, and look at it. Nobody else does. No big deal to anybody else because they don't have that, the amount of growth that we do. But I think that fence issue, the emails that I read yesterday, every one of them mentioned fences. So it's ugly fences. And the guy next door had the fence, he left and it all fell down and I had to deal with it. And it's all about fences. Not all, but it's a good portion of it. That might knock the big flames down in this controversy.
Well, and I threw the number out there, and I shouldn't have thrown the number out there. If they're claiming there's this many complaints, those complaints should be categorized as what they are. If they're duplicates, if they're the same property.
There's a spreadsheet on it.
Yeah. There should be, and I would like to have that information as well as far as...
It has to be usable information other than just the 1,000 reference, because otherwise it isn't usable. It's not defendable, and it's not quantified. You know, so I think that's a real liability that previous planning directors have used when they cite as an instigator for forming code and text amendment changes. Good. Wait a second. Careful what you use, because if you can't defend it, if you can't,
it becomes useless information.
Yeah. And then,
but if somebody calls in and says, "Yeah, it's those dope growers have barking dogs," you know what? There's barking dogs all over out in the rural community, and because the guy's a dope grower, it's his dog barking dog he gets complained on. And the lady says, "When my dog quits barking, I can hear theirs barking."
Yeah.
Okay.
Something that crossed my mind when Rob Bovet, I think we should send him a thank you note for a nice letter of thing I've come. And do you mind?
No. Nope.
Okay. The other one is, it came to my mind, or somebody made the recommendation, that we should probably issue a letter, a vote of no confidence to either OLCC or OHA, putting them on notice that their program is not working in Josephine County. It's. I think we need to really put the emphasis on the challenges, which you guys are both talking about, and really put them on notice. I think we need to have that mindset that when there is something that's supposed to be regulated by the state and it's not working, how do they know if the local current governing body doesn't tell them?
I think that letter would be probably appropriate to the governor regarding a vote of no confidence.
Absolutely. She's the administrator.
And what's strange is I just learned that Oregon Health Authority just put 48 inspectors into our county, have just been harassing people left and right, essentially doing all these inspections to try to make up for something when...
They should have been here years ago.
And all the laws were just changed that said create a database so we can see who's registered or not, and create a phone number so local entities can contact you.
How are they coordinating with us? Why am I learning this through, you know, where's the press release? Where's the notification? How come we haven't had a meeting with
them? And I learned from Rob Ovette that they can't have the phone number in time, that they say they can't figure it out. Why can't they figure it out? I had to learn from Representative Wilson's staff at a meeting that this is going on, and that's just it, is it's not working.
Well, I've had people on the street say, tell me there aren't 70 DEA agents staying in the motels at North Town. That's news to me.
Maybe that's what
they're talking about.
I don't know. That's
DEA has nothing to do with the state.
The sheriff, yeah, but you know how it is. You know those acronyms, people out there don't. They have no clue what you just said. And for them, they're drug agents. And so they just put a name to it, and away they go. But I would think if that was something like that happened, the sheriff would have to be notified before that came down.
I think he does.
It's still his jurisdiction.
That's his wheelhouse, for sure. Well, maybe we talk about a letter this afternoon, so let's remember to do that. Of what we.
That was true. There was also, we mentioned a letter of no confidence in our conversation with the city the other day to the Forest Service.
Yeah, that brought up another note I had, is I met with Mr. Pachorik, our local guy, a nice guy. I like him a lot, but I think the decisions of what's been done here locally probably weren't necessarily his. They were higher up the food chain, but I had a conversation with a commissioner from Douglas County yesterday, and it was really funny. It wasn't funny, but he was suggesting that all of the counties ought to write a letter. And I don't think that's such a bad idea to the Department of Interior or Agriculture, notifying them that we got to do better here. But I've been an intern back in D.C., and I know who reads those letters, and they read them just long enough to be able to file them in a box so they're all categorized, and then they click a button as a response and it says, thank you very much for contacting Secretary Perdue or Zinke on that very important issue to him. He's glad you wrote. He's going to be looking into that and in his coming term and blah, blah, blah. That's it, really, for what. I only say that because the reception that we're getting out of the Department of Interior for having made visits back there, the secretary came out here, heard from three commissioners on the executive committee about the challenge with the expansion of the Siskiyou Crest, and his leaked letter, so I don't even take it with a grain of salt, says that they're going to address 17,000 acres out of that, potentially, as its reference for ONC. The number isn't 17,000. It's nearly 40,000 acres of that 44 expansion was ONC designation. You can't really pick half and say the other half doesn't really count. It's just as though they're not really picking up what we're putting down. So, frankly, lawsuits are the best way to delineate specifically what your challenge is and what you want to see as an outcome and enlist it. And they pay attention to that. They have to, because the judge is requiring them to respond. So I think litigation is going to be my mantra for a little while, as far as until we see some actual that they're listening to us.
What level would it take to get the coordination committee going, and would that be something that would be
pretty easy to do? I think it's just outlining the structure, like what we went through with the cannabis advisory committee. We said there's 9 and an alternate. That's basically what you start with, and I think you start with a core, and you give that committee the authority to grow over time as they see other issues coming up, like the one that I went over to in Oahu. It had been on the books for years, and it had capacity for 60 members. There's a core group of 9, but there's subcommittees that they can say, we've got one person from the equestrian deal, but they got serious issues with blah, blah, blah. Dial it up. Get 6 of your buddies together so you know exactly what's going on from every square corner of this county, and then you've got an equestrian subcommittee. And that's how they get to 60. But it doesn't have to start that way. It takes bylaws, which we need to draft, and then you need to advertise for it and populate it. Let's do that before the end of the year. Let's have that as a goal.
I thought we had already approved going for...
It's just a matter of time. Just a matter of time. So.
And you mentioned the district that we were going to host a meeting on October sometime.
Yeah, and I think that's
October 10th.
I think it's morphed a little bit. So for the preliminary meeting to just be an introduction to the concept of what are we going to do, but really collecting all of the economic data, I don't know that really is much more than an agenda item on a broader meeting. And so I don't want to require a bunch of commissioners to drive down, because there's 2 other land use issue meetings coming up. AOC's meeting on October 9th, that Monday, if that's the month.
It's the day before, yeah.
Is that Monday?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's Monday. And then the ONC Association is meeting in Klamath Falls that Friday. So you've got 2 bodies, okay. AOC's Public Lands and the ONC.
Is everybody that you were inviting in the ONC? Can you guys combine it into the Friday meeting?
That's what I was looking to do, is have an agenda element then. Say preliminary, I think you guys, who's interested in having a meeting of that sort? And in the meantime, you need to be contacting your chambers and collecting data. I think before that meeting, I could have a brief letter from Stoll Reeves exactly what it is we're looking to try to do. They said there were 3 different options for how to...
If you're going to ask people to collect data, I think you need to give them a list of suggestions as to where to look.
Yep.
Just like talking to somebody yesterday about
health.
The bees.
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, you talk to a beekeeper, you go, well, yeah, smoke puts them back in the hive. So for 3.5 weeks, they were in the hive. Nothing went on.
Yeah.
And, what's the ramification of that? What's the downside of that? What did they do in that 3.5 weeks that they should have been doing?
Sleep.
Your parks department, your public health, your hospitals, your schools.
Fresh Water brought up a great example of 5 people that had heart issues in
Medivac.
Illinois Valley, and the Medivac was shut down. These were all, and just when I talked yesterday, I talked to Mr. Petorek and his counterpart, and they said, well, we're going to do some burns and some, get rid of it. I said, you're missing the point. When you do those burns because of poor timber management, now you have to do those burns. And what are you doing? You're still pumping carbon up into the thing. You're doing exactly what the environmentalists don't want you to do in the first place, rather than taking care of the fuels in the first place. You go clear back to what started it. Like, in the example, when I was in business and I started going sideways, I didn't just keep going sideways. I went back to when it worked. And that's what you need to do. Go back to when the forest thing worked. And then maybe you can find your answers. But I don't think they're interested in that. So. My problem.
Okay. Any update on 210 Tacoma?
we need to do that offline in executive session.
So, meeting with somebody tomorrow out there, that's a potential somebody who could be on site. I just got an email from Mr. Graves' concern over keys at the building. Did you get that as well?
I'm looking at it.
Okay, I'll let you read that.
I'm waiting until I get back to my desk before I read my emails.
That's true. We could address it at 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
So let's just move it to them. I'll figure out what I need to know and then. Okay. But nothing further? Words adjourned at 11:34.